Good morning. This is Jeff Blankford. Welcome you to the September 12th edition of Takes on the World, a program on international affairs that has come your way the second, fourth Wednesday mornings of every month and every other fifth Wednesday since the first week of January 2001, in which you are now hearing at a new time. Hardly a day passes when there's not at least a single reference to interference in our elections in 2016, as well as in the current cycle. Moreover, there seems to be not a day that goes by that Russia, and particularly its president, Vladimir Putin, is not blamed for some crime here or elsewhere. Congress even passed new sanctions on Russia for its alleged role in the near-deadly poisoning of the former Russian intelligence agent-turned-British spy, who, along with his daughter, were taken seriously ill after coming in contact with what the old world was told was a nerve agent developed in the old Soviet Union, but never reportedly produced. There has, however, been nary a word in the mainstream media or on NPR about the interference in our elections and our internal political processes of a close ally of the United States that has been doing both for years, most of it in plain sight. More accurately, some of this interference has been reported, but not identified as such in the media, since, although completely unwarranted, it has become an omnipresent, accepted part of our national political life. I'm referring, as you may have guessed, to the actions of Israel and its supporters in the United States, whose power over President Trump and the present Congress has far surpassed everything that we have experienced under any prior administration. That itself has been excessive for decades, and considering that Israel is a foreign country and that the United States is, or at least claims to be, a sovereign nation. Despite being so germane to all U.S. actions in the Middle East, this subject has long been considered taboo by the mainstream media and the leading alternatives, which also demonstrably cater to the whims of Israel's American supporters. Not being one of them and believing the subject to be of vital interest and importance to you, our listeners, and to the country, I have gone out of my way over the years to discuss this tender subject without fears. That will continue today at 20 minutes past the hour, when I'll be speaking again with former CIA case officer Phil Giraldi, one of the foremost experts on Israel's interference in the workings of the U.S. body politic. We'll be discussing two articles that Phil has written on the subject for the UNS Review over the last month. One, Why Confronting Israel is Important, and Israel's Fifth Column, Exercising Control from Within the Government. You can tell this from the titles that Phil Giraldi pulls no punches, so stay tuned for that. Yesterday, September 11th, marked the 18th anniversary of what is commonly memorialized as 9/11. Although there were tragedies that morning at four locations, the one most remembered in the minds of the public was the collapse of the World Trade Center's towers in New York City and the 2,600 dead following their being hit by two domestic airliners allegedly hijacked by members of Al-Qaeda. The subsequent collapse of nearby Building 7 in the same complex, which was not hit by anything but was ordered pulled or taken down by the Trade Center's owner, Larry Silverstein, has led to questioning of who was behind the attack and how it was carried out, stimulating controversies that are still going strong and circulating over the Internet while being totally ignored by the mainstream media. The man who, we are told, confessed to masterminding the attack, Pakistani-born Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, was arrested there in 2003, taken to a secret black site in Poland, where he was reportedly waterboarded 183 times. After that, he began to, quote-unquote, cooperate, according to the New York Times article from 2008. He was subsequently shipped to Guantanamo, where in March 2007, after 6 months of detention and more alleged torture, he confessed to not only masterminding the September 11th attacks, but the Richard Reed shoe bombing, attempt to blow up an airliner over the Atlantic, the Bali nightclub bombing in Indonesia, the 1993 World Trade Center bombing, and a number of other foiled attacks, 31 in all. ABC News had been told by CIA officials that, quote, Mohammed lasted the longest underwater boarding, 2.5 minutes before beginning to talk, end quote. Well, legal experts say this could taint all his statements, which may explain why he and his four alleged accomplices will never be brought to trial. Meanwhile, the war the Bush administration launched in Afghanistan in response, and the numbers of Afghans who have died there dwarfs the number who perished at the World Trade Center. Monday's New York Times, in an article describing a wave of successful Taliban attacks against Afghan military and police installations, noted that in the first 10 months of 2016 alone, 6,785 Afghan police and soldiers had been killed by the Taliban, an average of more than 20 a day. Since then, according to the paper, the U.S. military has classified the casualty figures as secret at the request of the Afghan government. Meanwhile, as part of the continuum that began with the Bush administration's response to the events of 9/11, a shooting war between Russia and the U.S. may be closer than ever before. The site, not surprisingly, is Syria. On Sunday evening, as Russian and Syrian warplanes continued bombing raids over al-Qaeda-held Idlib, the Wall Street Journal, citing unnamed U.S. officials, claimed that, quote, President Bashar al-Assad of Syria has approved the use of chlorine gas in an offensive against the country's last major rebel stronghold, end quote. How they knew this, the article doesn't say, but the U.S. has repeatedly accused the Syrians of using chemical weapons even when none had been found on the scene, as Robert Falk of the London Independent described on Takes on the World in June when he learned in the Syrian town of Douma that what the U.S. and Western press had reported as a chlorine attack in that city was denied by the residents with whom he spoke. Well, this morning on NPR, they say some official organization has said it was chlorine, so who's to say? Well, moreover, there have been a number of reports from reliable sources through the Syrian war that outside forces such as ISIS and the al-Nusra Front, the al-Qaeda franchise in Syria, were in possession of chemical weapons and were likely using them, anticipating correctly, as it turned out, that the Syrian government would get the blame. This is a setup in Idlib to watch for. The Wall Street Journal story broke after reports had circulated that the Russian Navy and Air Force had staged a week of large-scale military exercises in the Mediterranean coast off Syria. Footage released by Russia's defense ministry showed Marine Special Forces landing on the shore of Syria's Latakia province under the cover of dozens of Russian combat aircraft. More than two dozen battleships reportedly participated in the exercise, as well as three of Russia's newest frigates, which practiced launching anti-ship missiles. In the air, Tu-160 Blackjack bombers and long-range Tu-142 Bear submarine hunters simulated missile launches. At the same time, Karen DeYoung reported in the September 6th Washington Post that, according to Department officials, President Trump, who just 5 months ago said he wanted to get out of Syria and bring his U.S. troops home soon, has agreed to a new strategy that indefinitely extends the military effort there while launching a major diplomatic push to achieve American objectives. Quote, although the military campaign against the Islamic State has been nearly completed, she writes, the administration has redefined its goals to include the exit of all Iranian military and proxy forces from Syria and establishment of a stable, non-threatening government acceptable to all Syrians and the international community, end quote. In other words, what Washington is gunning for in Syria is another regime change. She goes on to quote James Jeffrey, who she describes as, quote, a retired senior foreign service officer who last month was named Secretary of State Mike Pompeo's representative for Syrian engagement, as saying, quote, the new policy is we're no longer pulling out by the end of the year. Jeffrey said U.S. forces are to remain in the country to ensure an Iranian departure in the enduring defeat of the Islamic State. That means we're not in a hurry, he said. Asked whether Trump had signed off on what he called a, quote, a more active approach, Jeffrey said, I'm confident the president is on board with this, end quote. Jeffrey declined to describe any new military mission, wrote the Post Karen Young. But he emphasized what he said would be, quote, a major diplomatic initiative in the UN and elsewhere, and the use of economic tools, presumably including more sanctions on Iran and Russia, and the stated U.S. refusal to fund reconstruction in Assad-controlled Syria. But, noted Karen Young, the more activist policy that Jeffrey outlined, and only in vague terms, could increase the likelihood of a direct confrontation with Iran and potentially with Russia. What the Washington Post Karen Young does not mention is that for the past 5 years, James Jeffrey has been a, quote, distinguished fellow at the Washington Institute for Near East Policy. And, where I'm quoting from its website, he, quote, he focused on U.S. diplomatic and military strategy in the Middle East with emphasis on Turkey, Iraq, and Iran, end quote. The Washington Institute is a major pro-Israel think tank formed by AIPAC, the American Israel Public Affairs Committee, in 1985, not to lobby on Israel's behalf, but to make policy on Israel's behalf, and the record shows that it has done that. Clearly, it has enhanced Israel's ability to enter into the inner circles of U.S. foreign policy and shape it in a manner that satisfies the agenda of Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. The open-ended vote by Congress after the events of 9/11 to allow President George W. Bush to take whatever military action he believed necessary anywhere in the world against al-Qaeda has been used as justification for the U.S. military presence in Syria, although the evidence shows that in Syria, the U.S. has been allied with al-Qaeda's affiliate, the al-Nusra Front, from its inception. That makes the continuing presence of the U.S. military a violation of the War Powers Act, passed under the presidency of Richard Nixon, designed to limit the powers of the president from sending U.S. troops into combat without congressional approval. The maximum time the president can do that under the act is 6 months, after which he must go to Congress or the troops must be withdrawn. But no matter who is the president and what party she or he represents, Congress has proved spineless and Syria is a classic case. At the same time, a handful of liberal Democrats who are reluctant to invoke the War Powers Act regarding Syria are ready to do so for Yemen, which is a good and necessary thing because the active U.S. support for the war being waged by Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates could not continue without critical support, which includes in-air refueling of Saudi aircraft and providing targeting intelligence. Last Thursday, a group of House Democrats, including Ro Khanna of California's Silicon Valley, Adam Smith from Washington, Mark Pocan from Wisconsin, who you hear on the Tom Hartman program, and Jim McGovern from Massachusetts announced that this month they would introduce legislation invoking the War Powers Resolution, forcing a vote on ending what they assert is unconstitutional U.S. participation in the biblically catastrophic Saudi war in Yemen and would seek Republican co-sponsors and support in doing so. They offered a number of reasons why this should happen now, the first of which that this U.S.-backed Saudi-United Emirate war in Yemen has created the worst humanitarian crisis in the world. As the congressman noted, the people of Yemen now face the world's largest humanitarian catastrophe, where 22 million people require humanitarian assistance and almost 18 million lack access to food, largely due to the Saudi war and blockade. And that they say there is no prospect this war will end until the U.S. pulls out of its participation. They're asking their voters to ask representatives to sign on the legislation when it is entered into the House. Finally, following Netanyahu's agenda, the Trump administration has not only ended U.S. funding for UNRWA, the U.N. Relief and Works Agency set up to assist Palestinians made refugees by Israel's ethnic cleansing of their country in 1948, the White House believes there's a right to determine who is qualified for refugee status. Under no circumstances, according to Trump, would any Palestinian have a right to return to what was once Palestine, despite international law and U.N. resolution passed in 1948 saying otherwise. Moreover, on Monday, John Bolton, Trump's national security advisor, declared that because of the defeat of the Palestinian Authority, refusal of the Palestinian Authority to meet with U.S. officials as a result of Trump's recognition of Jerusalem as Israel's capital, and because against Washington's wishes, the Palestinian Authority filed a complaint against Israel with the International Criminal Court in The Hague, the Washington office of the PLO will be closed. In a speech on Monday, Bolton threatened the International Court with sanctions if it pursues investigations of the U.S. and Israel, which could include barring judges and prosecutors from entering the United States, as well as freezing their U.S. assets if they have any. If the court comes after us, Israel, or other allies, we will not sit quietly, said Bolton. Sanctioning the International Criminal Court? Well, clearly the inmates have taken over the asylum. This is Jeff Blankford. Thanks for listening.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, This Week in Palestine.
Zuflet الفوز فزح طفلة.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to This Week in Palestine, where each week you will hear the Palestinian narrative, the Palestinian perspective, the Palestinian voice exploring the realities of the Israeli occupation of the Palestinian homeland. You will not hear this narrative very often in the Western media, which is why it is so important that we present it here each week on This Week in Palestine. This is your host, John Roberts. This morning we have a conversation with a remarkable Palestinian storyteller, Fida Ataya, which took place during her tour of the United States, where she is conducting workshops and speaking throughout the Northeast. Fida discovered the power of storytelling on the knee of her grandmother, and as an educator is now using it as her means of teaching and resisting. She understands the power of storytelling, and I asked her to tell her story. Well, Fida, welcome to This Week in Palestine. It's lovely to meet you. Your reputation precedes you. We've heard about you from friends here and the work that you're doing, so it's very exciting that you're here. And really appreciate the opportunity to speak with you and for you to share your story with our audience. So let's begin with your story. Who are you? Where did you grow up? How did you get into theater and storytelling? And how do you see your mission in terms of the use of your talents with people in Palestine?
So I was born in Ramallah, as well as I live in a village next to Ramallah called Kafr Naama, far away from the center, 15 kilometers. I live with my parents. Mm-hmm. I grew up in this village with the nature, with the mountains, with really a little bit and a lot of playing and hiking on the ground here, up to the trees. You know, it's like really real, natural child. Growing up. Then, yani, I have like four brothers and three sisters, and we all attend with my parents. And I used to live in a social place in a village. We used to have some sheep, and we used to have a lot of friends coming, going, a lot of cousins, neighbors. We all used to be together, playing together, even had been each other working together, as well as I was really child, and I used to learn a lot of things in the same time, which the place I was used to live in, like a lot of things going on, you know? Even you are in the village, we're a really quiet place, but many things happening in the same time. I was born in February 1987. My name is Fida, and Fida name means like you give your soul for something for free. So.
Lovely name.
Who gave me that name? My uncle. My uncle, when my mom was pregnant, he came, girl or boy? Then she said, I don't know really. And then he asked her, if she will be female, you must call her like Fida. And she said, okay, if we were a girl, we call her Fida. And he said, no, Fida Eya should be. It means like Fida Eya, like the freedom fighter. We call Fida'i, and Fida'iya, women freedom fighter. And as I told you, I was born 20 of February 1987, and my uncle, he became a martyr 20 of February 1988.
Oh.
In the same day.
Same day as your birthday.
Thank you. After 1 year, he passed away in the old city of Ramallah, and he became the first martyr in the old city of Ramallah in the first intifada. Guess. I grew up with family who lost two people, like two martyrs in the first intifada, as well as they used to be active in a popular struggle.
Mm-hmm.
And I grew up with this. I used to go to the child club, to the school, kindergarten. We used to play a game I still remember. We used to pick flowers, and we brought like a black vibes, a plastic one. We roll it as a circle, and we used to have like from the huge tree trenches, and we used to roll it around with the flowers. And we used to play the game of martyrs.
Play the game of martyrs?
Yes.
Wow.
As I still remember this, I became conscious about the things I was playing when I grew up.
I know.
Then I used to play that game as well. I used to play that, this game, the demonstration game. Ta ta ta, mm-hmm. ta 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 ta, like one, yeah. two, three.
Yeah.
You know? Without conscious, things was going on affected me as a child who was living in this quiet, beautiful, natural place in Palestine. Without conscious, that happened to me.
Mm.
As well, just in the first intifada when I was like a like between like my mom told me I was really baby, and the Israeli surrounded the house and the village. Then they start to throw the gas and the bombing. And entered the house, the gas. Then I became like, I could not breathe. And they took, and they saved my life in the last minute because I was really baby.
Hmm.
And the people.
You were suffocating.
Yes. They survived. Yeah. They saved my life in the last minute, as my mom told me. And this is nothing. Just like we are living at that's marks that we are living under the Israeli occupation.
This is normal life. This is, yeah.
This is minimum things.
Yeah.
What's happened to my family? This is maybe minimum things, small things comparing with huge things happening.
What other people?
Was in the same time in Palestine. So I grew up little by little. I went to the school in the village, and I finished the school. I was very active, playing sport, running, having many things. Then in the end, just like I went to the university to study like finance, then I recognized that it's not mine.
You went to Al-Quds University?
To Anarwa College
to
study finance. Then I changed the course. I went to study education as I am, like I want to study education.
Mm-hmm.
Before, I just was wondering who I am.
Yeah.
Who I am, really, in this crazy place. One day I remember myself at the class at the university with a professor. He was telling us about how to be in the educational system. You should be respectful, you should be nice with all, you should prepare everything, you should be like that person who the children will look forward to you, like to be with you and to be like that. And the same date of this professor who was saying that to us in this, I used to sit in the middle of the class having my pencil and writing notes as well as I used to study, but just only from the notes I took. And that day was a strike for the schools. The children on the street.
Mm-hmm.
There is no schools anymore.
No school. No.
Okay. The professor, he's enjoying the class and he's telling this for us. And I broke the pencil. Then because there is no sound except my pencil, they all looked at me and they start to laugh. And the teacher said, "What's wrong with you, Fidel?" I said, "What's wrong with you, my teacher? You didn't see the children on the street? They did not go to the school? What's to be respectful? What this mean to be like in this educational system, which is really, it seems fake one with this circumstances we are living in? Why you didn't discuss about that? Why you didn't make that big, huge now discussion about what's really going on in the reality? Why we should play on the sky what's underground that's broken? Why? I'm not going to be in your course. I'm sorry.
Mm.
I must leave right now." I left his course. I did not come back to his course. Then I was asking myself, who I am, what I want from this life. To be involved with this educational fake system, or to be like fighting. I don't know, this shit occupation came to us since 70 years ago, or what? Or no, to hide myself, closing my eyes, ears, and relax, and live my fake normal time and life in Palestine. What shall I do? Then this moment came to my brain, the memory of my grandma. My grandma, she's blind, as well as she could not move her leg and hand, for she had a heart attack.
So she had paralysis?
Yes. Mm-hmm. For her, because she was very sad for her only son, the Israelis, kicked him outside of the country.
Oh, yeah.
So she became very angry, very sad, until she became blind, and she had the heart attack. This is very important. I used to sit on her leg.
On your lap. Yeah.
Thank you. And she used to tell a story, not only for me, for other children from the from my family.
Yeah.
And I can remember until now the feeling like I'm sitting on the cloud, flying on the sky, everywhere, having the freedom from the story.
It was just transported by the story.
Yes, exactly. Which make me feel, oh, yes! Maybe I want to
That's
be like grandma. I went, Mama, see, this happened. I don't like what's going on. And she said, okay, I want to be like my grandma, like your mom.
Yeah.
And she said, what? What do you mean by that? I said, I want to tell stories. And she said, no, you are killing me. No, you are really killing me. What? You are studying baccalaureus right now. And you want to be like old-fashioned women telling stories? Are you using your brain? I said, I want to tell you, Mom, how much important to tell stories in Palestine. Yeah. I went outside the house. I was looking around children. Hi, child. Do you know that story, Hassan Shatter? He said, no. Do you know Hdadun's story? No. Do you know Al-Khunfus' story? No. All the children, they don't know the stories, the traditional Palestinian stories. How I can be Palestinian without knowing anything about our heritage, our traditional Palestinian stories? How I can be? Then, shway, little by little, it was crazy, because in that time, that was 10 years ago, you don't have any women, a storyteller, her profession to tell a story in Palestine. For who I am, I'm looking forward, only for my grandma, which used to tell, not in public spaces, but I'm in big challenge. How I can make like people believe me, and calling for me, and asking me to tell stories. And I'm not that person who's really good in speaking. I'm that person who's really good in, she's good in running and flying and playing, you know, playing around. I'm not that person, Yani. What I did with myself? Why I do that? And why I did that in my life? Why I put myself in the fire? Why? Then I said, okay, you put yourself in the fire, because this is the only way to be. Otherwise, you will be like following others.
Mm-hmm.
You will be like tool for others. And that means you will be like not a human being.
Mm.
So, yalla, tell stories. Okay, I will continue my education then, in baccalaureate in education. I finished it. That will help me a lot. To see the education of storytelling, then, yes, I must learn as much as we can from the old people that are still alive in Palestine. I was traveling here, there, in my village, other villages, to meet that people. I was listening from them, hearing from them, just like got to know close, and we are really friends, good friends together, as we still, old Palestinian men and women, especially women. Then I said, okay, fine. traditional best singing stories, but I'm 20, 21. The traditional story is very deep. Sometimes maybe I tell something, the deep meaning which I don't know. Yes, drama in education, to study drama in education, that will help me to analyze the story.
Comes together.
Exactly. Three years of drama in education. Mm-hmm. I was studying, applying, even the researches I did about storytelling, you know, the three researches for the 3 years. The last one I did, the last research I wrote about, you know, I proved that the story is exactly the drama, as well as the element of the drama exactly is the element of the story. Okay. Okay, perfect. With that, I became very active in Palestine. I used to tell a lot of stories everywhere. I do remember 2009 when the Ministry of Culture called me to perform in the middle of Ramallah Old City, outdoor performance. It was like part of Heritage Day, Palestine Heritage Day. Then I looked to myself like that. It was huge, many people outside, all kinds of people. And they are waiting for something. They don't know what this will be. And they said in the mic, let's welcome to the storyteller who will tell us the story. And they looked, what's this? But they were not caring about me, you know. They were talking to each other and just like outside the outdoor, yani. Then I step. Before I step, I went back quickly looking to the old shop. I wanted this traditional Palestinian dress. I took it from here. I wear it quickly. I went back to the stage. Then no one looked at me even. Okay, never mind. Then I started my story. Jam, jam, yama, jam. Once, time ago. Ditchan in Kabil, ditchan. Here is store beside the store. Little by little, I can see all the faces like, then, looking to this young girl, let's say young woman, telling story. That action, I did not expect that we will listen even, because we are not good in listening as Palestinians. We have a lot of things to do, and we are not really good. So that makes me more believe in what the things I'm doing, something really rare, you know? Unique. Also, people, they're hearing me like that, Palestinians, and they asked me for to repeat the story when I finished. That's like huge things. 2008, when I went to the school to tell the story, first time when I started, the teacher said, what you are going to do? I said, oh, I'm going to tell a story. I'm a storyteller. And she said, what? Habibti, my love, please don't do that. If you are a clown, you are welcome. If not, I'm not going to make my students lay down and sleep after your story. I will make them like active. I said, oh, why you judge me like that? Why you don't want to enter and watch the things I'm doing? I would love to invite you to be in the class and to see. Just give me like 40 minutes. And that's the things I want to ask you forever. And she said, oh, why she speaks like that? Okay, welcome. I entered. It was like for the third grade. I told them a story. It was very interactive performance. Very nice performance about a woman has no children and she found a cat. Traditional Palestinian story. And the teacher was sitting as the children were all sitting and listening, interacting. And the teacher, she became very crazy. When the ending of the performance, she came to me and she said, tell me when you would like to come back. I would love to just host you again and again and again. Just like did not expect. I thought that you are very boring person. And just like, so, to build that skill in my body, in my soul, it was very hard to use my body freely, just come by years. To have that knowledge of storytelling and a lot of stories in my body, in my brain, That's make me like travel in whole Palestine, listen to the stories from many people, old people, listening to the old stories, which really give you crazy energy when you listen to the stories. And that things I use it on a stage. I do improvise a lot. And the people can clearly believe the stories I'm telling them. Because I do believe all the stories I just tell for the people just because I don't lie. Just really, that's a story, that's character. I don't act the stories because I am the storyteller, yeah. You know? And then I said, okay, fine. During that period, I decided to be a storyteller. I took like more than 25 workshops inside Palestine, outside Palestine, about storytelling. About storytelling, the traditional Palestinian stories, storytellers from France, Germany, Sweden, also Lebanon, U.S., Britain, I was involved with everything around storytelling. About storytelling inside Palestine and outside Palestine. So I started to create my own performances based on my experience, okay? And which really make me more and more stronger and because I do apply and I have that experience in the real location. Then I said, okay. Real stories. A friend of mine, she's Swedish, we used to work together, and she invited me to the Freedom Theater to lead with her drama and education project as I finished my drama and education. Then she said, and also please, can you make like a storytelling workshop for children and performances every month? I said, yes, that would be nice. Then I started that. Then I noticed that they have like a Ben River who was leading the Freedom Bus 2011. Then I got involved with the things he's doing, and he said like we are doing playback. I was very excited to know more about the playbacks because it was like very new in Palestine. Mm-hmm. And okay, very nice. And then he said, yes, I want to learn that because it's about real stories. About real stories, which I'm not really expert to tell. I'm expert in traditional stories, myths, and things like that, but not real stories. So I just said, "Khalas, I want to study that." Then I start to perform in the playback theater group in Palestine with the Freedom Bus, making performances, storytelling performances, also playback performances, as well as I was also teaching playback at South in Hebron Hills with Ben Rivers. That's helped me in my storytelling as a profession. It's helped me to improvise more and more and to be courage on a stage. And that's something unique to see me because I'm wearing scarf, which I came from an Islamic family. And I came from a village. It's not popular to see a female wearing scarf, came from village, we're from family, Islamic family, and she do this kind of work. She go and sleep on the mountain, in the tent, and live in the refugee camp alone, and going to city, traveling outside Palestine. Something unique to find this in Palestine. And especially I told you about this, Yani. And thanks God, because I have supportive family, which they really supporting me, as well as I have very nice friends inside and outside Palestine, which really I believe them. And we believe each other. And all together, we can make change, really. So why I do that? I do that because without your tongue, how you can be? How we can be a story about Palestinians without having any story. I can see Palestine land started to be disappear little by little. And now in West Bank, we are living as Palestinians on a little piece of land divided by colonies and wall. Okay? How can be Palestinians without having a story? Can we create state then? I don't think we'll be state without story, even state without land. So in the same time, the land disappearing, as well as the Israeli occupation is still taking the land, as water, as everything, should not the story go away. The story should stand.
Yes.
Exactly the story. Mm. And our Nakba in 1948 is approved for our energy and power of our storytelling method, I used to work with the female in Burj Baraj refugee camp in Lebanon. They are Palestinians and everything. They learn about Palestine from who? From their grandma, father, old people. They used to tell them stories about Palestine and things like that. So the storytelling is very powerful method.
For generations, that's the way education. That's how you taught. You taught through storytelling.
Yeah.
You know, and it's interesting the way you talk about it now that it's somehow been lost, that or the value of it has been lost, and you see that. The importance of that, and that you're restoring, in a sense, you're, you know, bringing it back, but which is so important because it's been lost.
Yes, yes. About that, you only one person maybe can make change, but a little bit change. So about that, I went there, trying to extend. The things I'm doing as much as I can, as I see we must make a festival for starting in Palestine with another friends in Jordan because they started that. I used to be with them. Then it's continue with Palestine, and we did like last year a storytelling festival in Palestine with 37 storytellers from Palestine. You are not alone. I jumped when we received the application, me and my friend, and I looked, I counted, I said, no, I don't believe that. It's just like incredible.
You're not alone.
Yes, incredible. Incredible because you see new people started to be storytellers. As they want to be storytellers, you know, as their profession. You inspire others also, you know. You open the gate for others to wear a scarf and to be on a stage in the same time. Okay? Mm-hmm. And to wear a scarf and to travel all the world, you know. No one can limit you. No one can put border for you to stop your freedom. You decide yourself how you want to be in Palestine, outside Palestine. How you want to be as Palestinian, as rooted, as you must be. Mm. Otherwise, you will be disappearing like I don't know what. You know, that's allowed to me to go to Sweden for the festival there, storytelling festival, Edinburgh, we'll go to the French festival, and also as well to England, to the Brighton University, also to Tunisia, Carthage Theatre Festival for two times, a Jordan Hakaya Festival, so storytelling festival for like 9 years I was participating in this festival, Algeria, the storytelling festival, as well as Italy. I used to work with a theater reportage, Teatro di Nascosto, a hidden theater in Italy, in Volterra, with Annie Tinneman, who used to tell real stories. I am part of international group. We work all together. We make performances and improvisation everywhere, in France, Spain, on the beach, in the garden, in the street. Never mind. Work about dreams, working about real stories, about many, many things. Yani, about that, I said, okay, Palestine now. Yes, art and activism residency based on storytelling should be in Palestine. Now, 2, 3, 4. Five. Oh, I must investigate with Palestinians. No, should be many Palestinians, but it's for free. But it's not paid work. What shall I do? It was very, very challenge. It's easy to tell, easy to say. I'm now saying with my body, with my soul, talking to you. But it was very hard. You just decide to don't create your own personal life because you are taken from something else, and you must be focusing on these things because you are responsible as a Palestinian to share the story as much as you can to others Palestinians to make them learn about their roots, then second to non-Palestinians to make them learn about Palestine. And just like after years I realized that oh my God, and this, who I am. I just, all my things I do for others. What about myself, you know? Mm-hmm. What about myself? No, just like make me like, I'm really tired from the things. Why I must do that?
Yeah.
Why I must be responsible about the things happening since years in Palestine? Why? I dream because one day one journalist asked me, "Oh, what is your dream?" Then I stopped. I know, then I stood there, to be honest, I don't know. And she said, "No, we know that your dream to be a storyteller and to tell Palestinian story as much as you can." I said, "No, don't you, that's my dream. I'm sorry, that's not my dream anymore. It just wasn't even my dream, that was responsibility and decision, I decided. The dream to just sit under the tree, relaxing, breathing, drinking water from the spring, eating from the food I plant, having little sheep, can give me milk. That's it. I don't want any things in this life. And I don't want to dream. I'm not a dreamer to dream to have something big. I don't like. I'm not that person who's looking to be famous as well as I'm that person. About that, I work with really Palestinians who really have nothing. I don't have Facebook page, even. Just a month ago, I have my card. If you look to my experience, I'm expert in storytelling. Mm-hmm. So why I'm doing that? Because the people who I'm looking for to them, they are really different. So it's just like this. Yani, what we need as Palestinians in this earth, we need our land. We need to breathe, to sit, to relax. As a minimum human being sitting anywhere in the world, you know, with our land.
Just want to live your life as you define it. As that's
with minimum.
That's the vision.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes, it's not my
define
dream.
Define your life.
Yeah. And I feel like a huge things on my shoulders, you know, with the things I'm doing. That always pushing me to do the things as much as I can without stopping. And this is, I don't have any holiday in my life, as I don't.
No holiday?
No holiday. Maybe that's a lot. Maybe I do something bad for myself. But I live in an urgent emergency situation. Every second the Israeli come and take our land. Just 3 weeks ago in my village, with my favorite place ever, I was thinking to just live in this under the tree up to the hill, up to the tree, up to the mountain, and I wasn't in the village because I used to travel everywhere in Palestine. I was in another city called Turkerim in West Bank.
Sure.
Then I surprised when I back home that the settlers, the colonels, they are up to the hill. They took the hill, the soldiers. I went with my dog. My mom said, "Where are you going to?" I said, "I'm going to hike as usual up to the mountain." And she said, "Are you crazy? You don't see the demonstration right now? You cannot hear the bombing, the shooting? Are you going to kill yourself?" I said, "No, mama. I'm going to walk as every Friday with my dog."
It's my act of freedom. It's my, yeah.
Exactly. I went there. The Israeli soldiers did not let me just go where I go normally up to the mountain because they said, "This is the military area now." They took the land. As a family, we own land there. We have papers, you know? What's this right you have as a colonels to come and take our land? They have gun. They have everything. They can make the Palestinians scared to being like to otherwise would be killed as Palestinians. Then they were said, "Oh, Palestinians, they are terrorists. They throw stones. What? That we are throwing stones? You are taking our time like this? What this? Where's the justice?" I was looking to other Palestinians, sharing with them, being with them, being solidarity with them about what's happening in their land. And now it's our turn. It's my turn as my village. Just 3 weeks ago, I'm not happy to be in U.S. as well as what's going on, and this politic and the government of U.S. what they are doing, and always they have new things to make us falling down and right. to make the occupation up to the sky.
Supporting the occupation,
exactly.
supporting the military in
exactly.
Israel.
Exactly. Yeah. But I can see the peaceful U.S. people population, friends I have here, which really they are really supportive for Palestine and for our issue. I don't know what we call it, our Palestine things, our... So this is in general about me.
You used... talk a bit about the Freedom Theater in Jenin, and in particular, playback theater, and what that is, and how that's used, and how that is part of the resistance?
Yeah. It's everything's part of the resistance. This woman who's living in the tent in Jordan Valley with the 5 sheep without water, without electricity, without education for her children, while she's sitting there without anything, she's resisting. Otherwise, the Israeli settlers, colonels, will come and take her land.
Right.
She's resisting.
Right.
That farmer who's going every Saturday, Friday, Sunday, every day, morning early, to his mountain to plant and to make the sand in good way and the stones to make his land better,
mm-hmm.
that he is resisting in Palestine. When you go and tell stories, you are resisting. And what I used to work with the Freedom, I worked with the Freedom Theater as well. We are going now I am going to be part of the new production, both skateboarding and storytelling about freedom, to be honest, about birds and freedom. And Freedom Theater, I was co-leading the Freedom Bus for 2 years,
mm-hmm.
as well as I was part of the Freedom Bus for 4 years. I used to tell stories doing playback theater, and also I used to lead the tour for the group, the passengers, in whole West Bank, in Area C, as you know, in Palestine,
yeah.
in West Bank, divided the land after the agreement of Oslo agreement, Palestinian-Israeli, I'm sorry to say that, it's shit agreement, mm-hmm. and they divided A, B, C, the land, and A, for Palestinians and under control Palestinians, is 18%. B, for Palestinians and under control, both Israelis and Palestinians, and it's about 22nd percent. And C, it's for Palestinians under control Israelis, it's about 60% from the whole West Bank. If we look 60% as Palestinians, the Israeli government did not allow to us to build houses, to have water, to be access in education, to build healthy center or a school. That means you are not allowed to be. You mm-hmm. are not allowed to be in this earth. As much as they can, they're trying to kick us out. Mm-hmm. The Freedom mm-hmm. Bus used to have a Palestinians, international activist artists, students even, doctors and universities, professors. They used to all be together, traveling from north of West Bank until south of West Bank, passing the communities who's living in Area C, be in solidarity with them, living with them, hearing from them, doing a voluntary work with them, you know, also showing them some theater, a storytelling, music, and that Freedom Bus. Playback theater. The playback theater, it's an interactive theater based on stories came from the teller, real audience from the audience. And we do have like 4 actors, 1 musician, 1 conductor. And we invite, the conductor invite one of the audience to be a teller on a stage. And he or she used to tell a story in public for all. And then the conductor asks the actors to play back the story in front of her or him in the middle of this Palestine, as well as the teller choose every time someone from the actors to be him or her.
So you're asking people in the audience who came to tell their story, and they get up and they tell their story, and then the actors improvise and play back the story that the audience participant just gave. That's playback theater.
Yes, and that's a very nice method to be in solidarity with other people. To I forgot the word in English. Advocacy. Yeah, advocacy. That's advocacy tool.
Advocacy.
Yes, advocacy tool to highlight something or to make an audience for something. Because our heroes at the playback performances was the community members.
Yeah.
The tellers.
Right.
They are the heroes in the stage. That will make other Palestinians believe them and be in solidarity with them. Second, will make the teller look at him or her story, analyze. What's this? Also reflect, also evaluate.
Mm-hmm.
Third, that would be very nice educational method to learn from our experiences as Palestinians. And fourth, to build an audience for our crazy life, to be aware about what's going on through these performances. Fifth, to make that pillar and others release a little bit and relax after they see themselves on the stage. They will be relaxed a little bit.
So there's real therapy. It's real. It's a release.
Yes.
And when you live under occupation, and when you live under the kind of terror the Palestinians live with every day, that becomes very important.
That's like make you proud of yourself as Palestinian under occupation, living in very tough days, hard, crazy, many things going on. You're just struggling to survive, to be.
The purpose of the occupation is to break you. And this is a way that people who are powerless in many ways, don't have the guns, they don't have the control, are able to resist by telling their stories and in a sense emboldening each other to stand against this oppression. And that's the role. That's what you're doing. That's what you're doing. Very incredibly important.
This is the minimum, to be honest.
Yeah.
This is the minimum. We don't have anything anymore as we used to have. By years we are losing a lot of things. As if there's a Qatar will come and cut our town, that will be our ending as Palestinians. I hope there will be not any more Qataris will come and cut our town. About that, telling stories with all kind of methods is the most powerful, more than anything else. It's just most powerful form of a story of resistance, I think.
Mm-hmm.
That's amazing form of resistance. Minimum.
So this is empowerment. This is what you're about. Is empowerment of people by telling their stories and by being who they are, being who you are.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Being how you are is something not easy in Palestine.
And you know, we hear so often about the resistance and why the Palestinian people will grow is because of the power of their heritage and the power of their history and the love of the land. And there's no way you ultimately break that. And but it's so painful to see the suffering that goes on during this, and it's amazing. It's amazing that the resistance is so strong in the spirit of the people. You know.
Personally, my energy come from underground, as like the roots of the olive tree.
Mm-hmm.
As I always, when I teach storytelling for others, I tell them this: be as an olive tree rooted in the earth, down, right. Down, down. Then fly with your leaves far away, everywhere. Otherwise, will be a cutter. It's easy if you don't have that root. Will come and catch you and just throw you here or there. Someone or something will break you easily. About that, be rooted as much as you can to be a storyteller. That will help you to stay and to survive and to just be strong. طفلة تمتطي قوس قزح.
Back to BCFM's Politics Show with old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. As a shifty-looking Alexander Petrov and Ruslan Bushirov appear on Russia Today, they are their real names after all. Boris Johnson and Theresa May call them murderers, but where is the evidence, the perfume bottle, and the explanation why the so-called Novichok didn't kill the targets? They presumably have evidence on these Russian bunglers. Why aren't they sharing it with us? Could it be these apparent nerve agent attacks in Salisbury and Amesbury originate in Porton Down Chemical Weapons Labs, just a few miles away, right in between the two towns, Amesbury and Salisbury? Is there any link to MI6 and the CIA's battle with Moscow for Idlib and for Syria, 2,500 miles away from Salisbury? Meanwhile, more Russian nerve agents are discovered in Holland with help from the Swiss, who discovered them trying to hack into the Swiss government's chemical weapons lab. This all happened back in March, but we've only just been told. Also, expert nuclear scientist Chris Busby, who's been taking the MOD on and winning in the courts, he comes home to Biddeford in Cornwall earlier this week to find a wide police cordon around his home. They say his lab is a bomb factory. Exclusive interview with Chris plus Fukushima and the Skripals in a minute. And I'm off to Arnhem next week to look at the origins of the Bilderberg conferences for the 74th commemoration of the famous World War II battle portrayed in the film A Bridge Too Far. And a bit of help from Manfred Petrich later. He'll be here to explain the Nazi links between organised crime and Battle of Arnhem back then. Plus, Martin Summers takes us to some of the world hotspots the mass media turn a blind eye to. Our sister show Dialects Online, now at dialectradio.co.uk. This week, a regular Bristol visitor to Lebanon, Di Karawacki, recounts her experience of how Israeli invasions of Lebanon and ISIS jihadis next door in Syria impacted on Beirut and Lebanese life. We also hear from freelance technology journalist Chris Hewitt on promises back in 1975 from Shirley Williams and Roy Jenkins that joining the EEC, as it then was, would never lead to political or monetary union. Listen here at BCFM 93.2 at noon next Tuesday, or download it from dialectradio.co.uk now. And for Tuesday week's programme, we've got a real special, which is Joe House from the Climate Change Science Department at Bristol University, discussing, is climate change really man-made, with the Leader of the Opposition's brother, Piers Corbyn, an hour of really interesting, actually fascinating scientific discussion about climate change. That's Tuesday week at noon on Dialect. But we start, Martin, with this interview, extraordinary interview, aired on RT, and excerpts of which have been put on to the BBC, etc., with these two fascinating characters from Russia, Petrov and Bosirov.
Yeah, obviously we constantly, this is a soap opera that continues to develop. I think the most significant fact, though, is that they arrived in Salisbury 2 hours too late to have painted anything on the door handle. That's what it looks like at the minute. So the story about painting Novichok on the door handle has to go, or they have to go as the suspects because they arrived too late. And you could say, well, perhaps they did it the day before, but if they did it the day before, why did they come back the second day? Don't forget the Skripals left home, from what we know, at 9 a.m. and didn't come back. They may have come back, but the British police have to show us that they did come back, and then it becomes possible for them to have painted the door and for the Skripals to have touched it. Although, of course, they should have died immediately if it was Novichok. And that's another thing that hasn't really been okay, explained to us.
Why
only one person's died, although three people were, four people were supposedly in contact with
the stuff. Okay, so before we go any further into discussing the evidence, let's hear from Petrov and Bosirov themselves. And this was a bit of a more, this is about 4 minutes long altogether, but it's a bit more than we've been hearing on the news. We just keep hearing a few little excerpts. And so here's a bit more than the news people have been giving us here in London.
No, initially we planned to go to London and have some fun there. This time it wasn't a business trip. Our plan was to spend some time in London and then to visit Salisbury. Of course, we wanted to do it all in one day. But when we got there, our plane couldn't land on its first approach. That's because of all the havoc they had with transport in the UK on March the 2nd and 3rd. There was a heavy snowfall. Nearly all cities in the UK were paralyzed, and we weren't able to go anywhere.
Railroads didn't work on March the 2nd and March the 3rd. Motorways were also closed. Police cars and ambulances blocked off highways. There was no traffic at all. No trains, nothing. Why is that no transport was operating? Why is that nobody talks about
any
of this?
Can you give us a timeline, minute by minute, or at least hour by hour, or as much as you can remember? You arrived in the UK, like you said, to have some fun, to see the cathedral, to see some clock in Salisbury. Can you tell us what you did in the UK? You spent 2 days there, right?
Actually, three.
So what did you do for those 3 days?
We arrived on March 2nd. We went to the train station to check the schedule, to see where we could go.
The initial plan was to go there for a day, just to take a look and return the same day.
To Salisbury, that is. 1 day Salisbury is enough.
No,
we arrived in Salisbury on March the 3rd. We wanted to walk around the city. We tried to have a walk, but since the whole city was covered with snow, we only spent half an hour there. We were all wet.
There are no pictures, the media, television. Nobody talks about the fact that the transport system was paralyzed that day. It was impossible to get anywhere because of the snow. We were drenched up to our knees.
We naturally were going there to see the Stonehenge, Old Sarum and the cathedral, but it didn't work out. The whole city was covered with slush. We got wet, so we went back to the train station and took the first train to go back. We spent about 40 minutes at the train station, at a coffee shop.
We were drinking coffee, a hot drink, because we were drenched.
On March 4th, we went back there because the snow melted in London and it was warm.
It was sunny.
And we thought we really wanted to see Old Sarum and the cathedral. So we decided to give it another try on March 4th.
Well, don't you think that it's kind of stupid for two straight men to be carrying perfume for ladies? Why would a man have women's perfume in his bag?
Even an ordinary person would have such questions. Why would a man need perfume for women?
Long story short, did you have that Nina Ricci bottle or not?
No.
No, of course not.
Speaking of you being straight men, all the footage features you two together. You spent time together, you stayed together, you went for a walk together. What do you have in common that you spent so much time together?
You know, let's not breach anyone's privacy here. We came to you seeking protection, but this is turned into some kind of an interrogation. You're going too far.
So that's what they said, Martin, that they were going too far by prying too much into, you know, whether they're, what exactly their relationship between the two men was. They certainly looked quite well built, didn't they? Possibly military, but then some would say a lot of Russians are stocky.
Well, I mean, their official business, they claim, is basically helping bodybuilders by providing them with supplements. And what I felt about them is they are possibly involved in illegal supplies of steroids to bodybuilders, which is why they're a bit pretty cagey about what they actually do. Because what they actually do for business is possibly quite dodgy, which is why they're being a bit cagey about it. It could be that they are GRU agents. It's possible. And, of course, the Skripals switched off their mobile phones when they left the house at 9 a.m. that day, which is very strange. People don't do that, really, I suppose. I suppose they might if they don't want anybody to contact them. But it's possible that these are GRU agents who are trying to contact the Skripals as part of some undercover mission.
Well, we did hear, right at the very start of all this, back in March, in the Independent, from one of Sergei Skripal's friends. He actually contacted the Independent and said, well, I've been no Sergei, and he has been expressing a wish for some time to actually return to Russia. Now, this is very difficult for someone who's a former double agent. They're not just going to welcome him back at the airport, and he was trying to negotiate his return.
All right, well, this is all speculative, but let's say that these guys are GRU, and they come to Salisbury to find the Skripals. That's not necessarily the case. They may be, as they say, that what they need to be is interrogated. But it could be that the whole Novichok thing has been set up to set the Russians up. And, you know, the fact that the police officer has disappeared, that Skripal's disappeared, that Yulia's disappeared, and then when the story's dying, suddenly the perfume bottle appears and two people get died. But only one person has died. If it's Novichok, which they claim it is, then everybody should be dead straight away. If they came and painted the door. Now, what they're saying is it didn't work because they painted the door on.
Well, we sometimes skip over Dawn Sturgis and Charlie Rowley, that whole incident, and it's well documented now that they were actually on hard drugs, so their health wasn't particularly good anyway. No. All it would take would be a batch of bad drugs for one of them to cop it, really.
Interestingly enough, there was a statement by somebody from Salisbury Hospital saying that there were several people treated not for nerve agents. Several people were treated. None of them were treated for nerve agents. That's what the guy said. And there was no danger to the public. And in actual fact, the Skripals were treated as if they were fentanyl victims to begin with. Fentanyl is a very, very strong form of heroin, which has been going around in Wiltshire and elsewhere in the world, 100 times stronger than normal street heroin. And that the symptoms that they showed, although we've never seen any CCTV footage of the symptoms or anything, and it's not been explained to us how the police officer, and of course he's a detective sergeant, he's not a beat officer, he was also supposedly brought down by Novichok. Did he go to the house? Did he touch the door handle? All of this has not been explained. Now, leaving aside whether they're GRU or not GRU, this whole question of Novichok. I mean, most people have failed to recognise that the Russians, under supervision, when Craig Murray was the ambassador in Uzbekistan, dismantled their equivalent of Porton Down completely, and people came in and took everything away. We were supposed to dismantle Porton Down as a quid pro quo, but far from dismantling Porton Down, on the back of what's happened, they're going to get a massive investment of public money so they can carry on doing what they do in there. Now, don't forget that this whole idea, chemical weapons, chemical weapons, chemical weapons, is very much much a Western trope. The chemical weapons like the phosphorus that was used to attack Gaza or Fallujah, they are supposedly banned, but the Americans use them and they use white phosphorus. The point is they're not that much more dangerous than anything else. It's a whole thing of they've got to think of something that the Russians are doing which is illegal, where they can say,
well,
international
certainly
law doesn't
there seems
matter.
To be a very stupendous lack of evidence, but there is evidence emerging all the time. One of which is that just yesterday, the Skripal suspects, tourists, claims apparently are offensive to victims, the government says. And also the website Bellingcat has been doing a joint investigation with the Russian Insider, which has confirmed through uncovered passport data the two Russian nationals identified by UK authorities as prime suspect in the Novichok poisonings in Salisbury are linked to the Russian security services. What they say, Bellingcat says, has just published this, the Insider and Bellingcat confirm that two men were registered in the Central Russian Resident Database under the names Alexander Yevgenovich Petrov and Ruslan Timovarich Bosirov, respectively, and were issued internal passports under these names in 2009. However, no records exist for these two persons prior to that date, suggesting the two names were likely cover identities for operatives of one of the Russian security services. Crucially, at least one man's passport contains various top secret markings, in inverted commas, which, according to two sources consulted by Bellingcat, are typically reserved for members of secret services or top state operatives, but they won't show pictures of what those markings are or explain or confirm what those markings are at all on Bellingcat.
Bellingcat basically is a front organisation for MI6. It was set up supposedly by somebody who'd been made redundant from IT, and then they became an expert on all the kind of weaponry that was being used in Syria, and they've been pushed by the West as an independent, non-governmental voice and all the rest of it. But in actual fact, they just echo MI6 propaganda, and the general view of them is that it may well be that these guys are GRU, but Bellingcat is definitely MI6. So there you go. I mean, you pays your money, you takes your choice, you know. Who's lying here?
What about this more recent case as well, though, that we've got this so-called Switzerland connection, that Russian spies targeted the Swiss chemical weapons lab, the BBC reported 4 hours ago, and that story reads, the two Russian men were arrested earlier this year on suspicion of spying on a Swiss laboratory investigating the poisoning of Sergei Skripal. A newspaper investigation, Swiss publication Tages Anzeiger and Dutch paper NRC said they were arrested in the Netherlands earlier this year. The Swiss lab analysed samples from the poisoning of the former Russian double agents in the UK. Now, they were expelled from the Netherlands shortly after the arrest, which had not been reported up until now. Swiss intelligence told the BBC the agency had been actively involved in the case of the Russian agent without mentioning the laboratory of Spies, which is near Bern. The Swiss intelligence agency had confirmed the findings of its joint investigation with the Dutch newspaper.
Well, first thing I'd say about that is when they're arrested and expelled, that means there's been no court case here. Yeah? So there's been no court case, so nothing's proven, it's just asserted. Also, I understand that the Swiss laboratory, which may be the one they're talking about, analysed some of the whatever it was that was used, and they came out and said it was some other kind of nerve agent, not Novichok at all, okay? And I think that's checkable.
I think you're talking about BZ, aren't
yeah.
you? The one which is basically a kind of hallucinogenic drug which sends you into a frenzy but doesn't kill you.
Yes, and that sounds much more likely that's what we're talking about here than Novichok. Are you following me? And, of course, that means that what we're talking about here, therefore, is possibly a provocation by MI6. And I would say that the Russians have been saying all this week that MI6 are operating inside Idlib with the white helmets, and they've given lots of information and detail about a chemical weapons attack which is going to take place, which will be then blamed on the Syrian government. Now, you've got to remember that this, as I said to you earlier, this whole thing about chemical weapons, weapons of mass destruction, is a trope of Western intelligence services. Basically, the Russians got rid of all their stuff years ago because they got no use for it.
Okay, so one person that doesn't agree with you is Theresa May's Security Minister Ben Wallace, and here he is last night on Channel 4 News talking about this really, what I suppose it is what they seem to keep describing as a malign behaviour of Russia.
The EU has sanctioned 150 Russians, going right back to Crimea, who are still under sanction. And those 150 are the leadership of the Russian armed forces. They are some very senior people in the Russian government. And I'm confident by the response we received from our allies in March, when collectively the international community expelled 150 intelligence officers from around the world at an unprecedented scale, that their determination to push back malign Russian behaviour is as strong today as it was back in March.
So you're hoping for more from the EU summit next week?
Well, I'm hoping that eventually Russia will wake up to the existing sanctions that are in place, very significant sanctions going back from the Crimean and the MH17 shooting down of a jet. There is a clear path out of it for Russia, and one of those paths would, of course, be, you know, helping us deal with the two people we suspect of this attempted murder.
So, sorry, just to clarify, you're saying that you're hoping Russia will wake up to the existing sanctions. Is that because you don't think you'll get any more sanctions through
there is significant sanctions already in place, is my point. 150 people, all at the heart of the Russian state. And, you know, therefore, you can't sanction someone twice. You know, I'm not going to sanction the Russian chief of the general staff twice.
But is there any sign that they're working?
At the moment, you know, I'm not in charge of the sanction assessment. What I would certainly say is at the moment, you know, the Russian economy is not looking good. It is not in a good state. Remember, it is half the size of the British economy. And eventually, you know, the people of Russia, who I notice have decided that President Putin's pension reforms are not as popular as he hopes, will start to realise and make that connection that, you know, the economy is partly affected by these international sanctions driven out of the Russian government's behaviour.
Well, I mean, basically what he's saying there is we're going to make ordinary Russians suffer, you know, through pension cuts and so on,
overthrow the government. He's talking about wealthy Russians, isn't he? People who do make money out of international trading, that sort of thing.
Well, no, the pension reform is actually the pensions of the ordinary folk, yeah? And then Putin obviously has had some problems with that because he's trying to...
It's Putin that's doing that. It's not Ben Wallace.
No, I know, but the point is that what Ben Wallace is saying is that the sanctions on Russia have led to a situation where they've had to cut pensions for the ordinary folk, and the ordinary folk should then draw the conclusion that it's Putin's nasty behaviour that's led to their pension cut. Now, of course, in other words, they're using sanctions against the ordinary people in order to try and get the leadership isolated. Now, when he mentions MH17, and when most people are not aware of this, but there's been a court case in Kiev, Tony, in which the Berkut riot police were accused of massacring the protesters in Maidan Square, 80 protesters and several police officers, all shot by expert snipers with the same weapons and all shot through the head. And there's been a court case in Kiev, and the Berkut riot police were acquitted because two snipers from Georgia testified on a Skype link that they were the people who carried out the assassination, that there were 50 of them, they were all mercenaries from Georgia associated with Shakashvili, who's a big protege of the West, and that the actual operation was run by a US colonel who they named. Now, that's all been in court in Kiev, but it's not been reported on the BBC, has it? Because it completely undermines the whole story about what happened in Kiev 4 years ago.
Just an aside,
the people who were killed by NATO intelligence services, and a US colonel ought to be standing trial and going to prison forever.
Just as aside to what Ben Wallace had to say there, one of the things he just kind of dropped into the conversation was that the Russian economy is half the size of the UK economy. Why is that? I mean, obviously the Russians are more populated than Britain.
Yeah, but I mean, there's always been a problem for Russia of not being in the core of the world economy. They've been trying to catch up for years. In actual fact, the economy in Russia is actually, the sanctions actually have backfired massively because the Russians basically have gone for a self-sufficiency strategy.
Well, that's right. I was reading
That's what you do when
you're sanctioned. I was reading recently that actually the fact that their economy is small but their industrial output is large is actually a very good thing because it means that people are paying less for things, basic things like bread, water, transport. It all costs far less in Russia.
Yeah, well, Putin has been a success in terms of improving the basically miserable conditions that I used to find when I used to go to Russia in the 1990s, because they've stopped doing the stupid stuff. They've still got a nationalised oil industry. They've still got nationalised banks. They've still got a nationalised rail industry. And this is all a centre-right government in Russia, but they don't believe in privatising everything because they've seen what happens when they did. And that's why Putin's popular, because he's improved the living standards of the ordinary people and made them feel as if the government cares about them for the first time.
So it's got
when Yeltsin was running the show, and of course Yeltsin only scraped home by 50.1%.
Let's try and do this little thing. It's a bit of a game, I suppose, really. But comparing Britain and Russia and the economy and the country. Now, Russia in landmass is 70 times the size of Britain. It's much, much bigger. But its economy, its population is only about 2 or 3 times the size of Britain. It's 145 million, and Britain's is about 65, 70 million. So you're talking about roughly half the size in population, but 70 times greater in terms of size. So this whole idea of having a self-sufficient economy sounds like quite a good idea to me. Is it something that the Brits should think of, do you think, where there's not so much money every year spent on your basic essentials, things like transport, things like water, things like food, things like rent, and how much you're paying, for example, in a mortgage, etc.?
Well, look, you've got to recognise that economies are path-dependent. We're not going to have a coal industry in this country ever again. It's gone. We're never going back to having a coal industry. They've still got a coal industry in Russia, particularly in the Donbass, which is one of the ways that they used to earn foreign exchange. What they've done is they've used their nationalised oil industry to generate profits, which they've then invested in trying to modernise their economy. Don't forget, their economy was very unmodernised back in the day. They've had to gradually, they've gradually turned it around. They've got a basically capitalist economy, but they don't believe in the super free market. And they've balanced what they're trying to do. And of course, they've got masses of resources there, which is what this is really all about.
Now, you're surely not going to deny this malign Russian behaviour that Ben Wallace was talking about, the Britain's security minister there, pointing out, making a particular point of looking at what happened in Crimea in March 2014, and also the downing of MH17 in July 2014. Now, this is only 4 years ago.
Yes, and I just mentioned this earlier. There's been a court case in Kiev, which
you're talking about the Maidan protests. I'm talking about Crimea and the MH17.
Yes, but the Maidan
He didn't mention that.
No, the Maidan protests led to the breakaway of Crimea, just like Kosovo broke away from Serbia when we bombed Serbia for 73 days. Do you remember? We bombed the television station and killed their weapons. The girls. Do you remember that? Because Kosovo wanted to be independent
Russia,
of Serbia.
At which point Russia annexed Crimea.
No, they didn't annex it. The people of Crimea voted for independence from Ukraine, and the Russians accepted that, just as the people of Kosovo wanted independence from Serbia. But they still haven't been recognised by lots of countries, including Spain, for example, because breakaways aren't ever recognised, unless there's some particular reason. The people in Crimea are overwhelmingly Russian-speaking. They know that the Maidan Square massacre was carried out by the West, because they read it in their newspapers. We don't. And of course, it was even on the day, Umas Piets, who was the Estonian foreign minister, phoned Catherine Ashton, the British foreign spokesperson for the EU, and said, well, we've just been round the hospitals, and what we're being told is that the snipers that killed all these people were working for the new regime, not the old regime. And Agence France-Presse approached Umas Piets, and he confirmed the phone call.
So the evidence for the beginning of the crisis
is that NATO intelligence services killed 80 people and several police officers, and it wasn't the Russians, it was our people who should be standing trial.
What about MH17 in July 2014?
Well,
that was pretty obviously shot down by the Russians.
No, it was not, because in actual fact, they claimed it was shot down by a Buk missile. Now, in actual fact, if there was a Buk missile, there would be massive screenshots from all over the place of the missile being fired, and there aren't any. And you know what? The only people who had Buk missiles in the theatre were the Ukrainians. They had 7 Buk missiles in the theatre. If it was going to be shot down by the Russians would have to bring the Buk missile over the border, shoot the plane down, and move it back over the border into Russia without being detected. And also, of course, there would have been if you fire one of these missiles, there's a huge column of smoke.
You know what this reminds me of? Nobody's shown us. You know what this reminds me of?
Is
a little bit like Gaddafi, isn't it? Now, Putin is... we're being told the malign influence of Russia, malign Russian behaviour. They were saying exactly the same about Gaddafi. And he was... The specific things we were being told about him was that he was behind the Lockerbie bombing and he was behind the murder of PC Yvonne Fletcher. Now, the Dispatch's documentary, Death and Murder in St. James, absolutely conclusively proved that there was either MI6 or CIA behind the murder of PC Yvonne Fletcher, because of the ballistics and the trajectory of where the bullet came from. Could not have come from the Libyan embassy. Then we also had a break-in at Heathrow just before the Lockerbie bombing, and it looks as if this was investigation team from the United States who've been looking at other criminal behaviour of the CIA, who were heading back to do a prosecution in the United States of those people, and the Lockerbie aircraft was taken out because of that. So two things fitting up Gaddafi. We're now getting to the stage where there's a whole line of things being fabricated effectively to fit up Putin.
What you've got to understand...
But let's just say the Russian armed forces and Russia is not going to be quite as easy a country to take over and to depose the leader as Russia and Putin.
No, they're not.
As Gaddafi.
Well, yes, and what you've got to recognise is that the Western intelligence services are criminals and terrorists. So they have been for donkey's years. In Posimato, the head of the Italian Supreme Court wrote a book, La Repubblica di Stragi Impuni, about NATO intelligence services bombing Bologna railway station, kidnapping the Italian Prime Minister. He headed the Italian police force. Yeah, he's basically the head of the Italian police force. Now, most people in Britain are blissfully unaware of what CIA, MI6, etc. do. The Russians are saying that the SAS are in Idlib at the moment, working with Al-Qaeda to kill children using chemical weapons and blame it on Syria. Now, if you don't believe the SAS do things like that, I can only say to you, you don't live in West Belfast, you don't understand what goes on in the real world. And, of course, many people in this country, their knowledge of what goes on in the intelligence services is basically to do with watching James Bond films. That's what they know about it. And in actual fact, NATO intelligence services, according to police investigations in Switzerland, Belgium and Italy, are definitely involved in terrorism 30 years ago. And that's not 3 minutes ago, 30 years ago. And they haven't changed their spots because nobody's ever punished.
OK, let's go to Prime Minister's questions then this week, where there was a question asked about the Skripal poisoning. Another question, it's only the second PMQ since they came back after the summer, but they're straight in asking questions about Salisbury and the Skripals.
John Lamont!
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Given what we know about the Russian state's involvement in the Salisbury poisoning, does the Prime Minister think it appropriate that parliamentarians, both current and former, appear in Russian state television?
Minister!
Can I say to my honourable friend that I'm sure we all have doubts about the objectivity of the reporting on Russia today, which does remain a tool of propaganda for the Russian state. Now, decisions about appearing on Russia today is a matter of judgment for each individual, but they should be clear that they risk being used as propaganda tools by the Russian state. And I know that that is a view that is shared by other members of this House, including the Right Honourable Gentleman, the Member for Ross, Skye and Lochaber, who's made clear he doesn't think people should appear on that station. I would also say the same applies to Press TV, whose licence to broadcast has been revoked in the UK by Ofcom.
Well, that is quite interesting. Her last comment there is she doesn't want people to appear on Press TV, even though no one in Britain can watch it. So she's very much saying things like being Martin Summers. He appears on RT. So do you, Martin, risk being used as a propaganda tool by Putin?
Well, every time we go on air, we risk being used as a propaganda tool by somebody, don't we? And the point is, are we going to have a plurality of voices so that we can actually listen? I mean, for example, the whole question of the shootings in the Maidan Square. Russia Today are the only people who've reported that. It's absolutely crucial information that should be out there, and everybody should realise there's been a court case that pointed the finger at NATO intelligence services for killing all those people. And that should be out there, but it isn't. And the only place you can find that will be RT or coming on or shows like this. And that's the problem. And, of course, they're trying to close down Press TV and Russia Today because they give an alternative view from the one that Bellingcat comes out with, who's basically on the payroll of MI6, as far as anybody can tell.
And also, Google are endorsing Bellingcat. They're saying, this guy is a wonderful, doesn't come out with
any actual
fake
news. What he is somebody, I remember reading about him years ago, he's somebody who lost his job in IT and was bored, and then he went online every day and became an expert on the war in Syria, even though he's never been to Syria and he's not really an expert on weaponry either. But of course he's now an NGO, and as an NGO he can get funding to carry on doing what he does. And I do, when I appear on Russia Today, I sometimes get paid a small honorarium, if you like, for appearing, as you were, did when you were used to appear on Press TV. And I'm basically, I will go on anybody's TV. I'll go in the Sun newspaper to get my views across. And that, and everybody has got to recognise that in a pluralistic world, there's going to be different views, and you need to listen to everybody's
well,
view.
One of the things, actually, I did do a piece, I haven't seen it on Press TV for them recently, and did mention the background to a lot of this is that we've got an extremely weak government here, that the Theresa May, the Prime Minister, wasn't actually elected to be leader of the Conservative Party when Andrea Leadsom fell on her sword in the leadership elections after the referendum, the EU referendum. And also, of course, famously after last year's general election, Theresa May, the Conservatives are having to rely on the DUP, that would be a chance to be a fine thing, DUP, in order to stay, to keep their majority in the House of Commons. Also, many people have pointed out that Theresa May is a sort of security service appointment. So who is running the country? Is it the Conservative Party or is it the security services?
Well, I think it's a combination of both, isn't it? But I think there is leaving aside the internal politics in the UK, there is a long-running policy in the Operation Beluga. We know the name of the operation because Paul Borel, who used to head up the French anti-terrorist squad, told us about this, and he said there's an ongoing operation to prevent normal relations between Russia and the West. And therefore, every time that we move towards some kind of normalisation of relations, some incident or other happens to destabilise it. And the reasoning behind that is quite straightforward. The military-industrial complex in the West wants to spend loads of your money on fancy kit.
Okay,
and
final,
they need to justify
our
it.
Final
so that's
piece
why they do all of this
about
stuff.
Skripals was last night on BBC Question Time. This is, again, the prisons minister and Bilderberger, Rory Stewart.
I think it is shocking. I mean, the idea that these guys are going in to examine the squinch arches in Salisbury Cathedral or the tomb of William Long Espe is a kind of weird fantasy, and it's part of a whole Russian technique. This is maskarovka, which for the Bolsheviks from the very beginning of the 20th century has been about deception, and this is what Putin does again and again. Crimea, he said 5 weeks before he revealed that there were Russian troops there, he denied it absolutely, and he will keep doing this to test us. Which is why Julia's right. We need to respond. And we are responding. So expelling all those diplomats, and those diplomats are not normal diplomats, they're spies, right the way across from the United States across, putting the troops into the Baltic, these things are vital. If we had not put troops into the Baltic 3 years ago, it's very plausible that we would now be in a situation in which special forces would be popping up in Lithuania or Latvia and testing our resolve. This is his policy. It's an old Bolshevik policy, and you have to respond clearly, firmly, consistently, but above all, and this is where I think the government's got this right, honestly and calmly.
Okay.
Well, there he's comparing the modern democratically elected Russian government to the Bolsheviks, and he uses the word mashkarovska, deception. Now, we've just talked about a court case in Kiev, a court case which has shown that NATO intelligence services killed 80 protesters and several police officers. And we've actually got all the evidence that we need to point the finger. And as I mentioned earlier, Imposimato, the head of the Italian Supreme Court, was convinced that NATO carried out all the terrorism in Italy under Operation Gladio in the 70s and the 80s. I don't suppose Rory Stewart knows what I'm talking about, because he's a very posh boy and he's hung around with other posh boys who were part of the Tory party for years and years and years. And if I mentioned who Imposimato was to him, or even Umas Piets on the telephone call, he'd go, what? Because he don't know nothing.
What about his links to the attempts to overthrow Assad? Because he is a Bilderberg conference person, and there does seem to be quite a clear link between people like Rory Stewart and effectively a kind of almost international criminal network. He's the sort of person who is put forward to almost defend the indefensible, for example, the utter disaster in Birmingham prisons. And he has an incredible sort of ability to defend the indefensible, that is to say things like privatisations of our prisons, when we know that actually what's going on here is that the private shareholders have got absolutely no interest whatsoever in the welfare of people who are put in jail. And it can even lead to lobbying for more people to be jailed so that more people are sent to prison, even though they don't necessarily have to be.
Rory Stewart quite clearly has very close contacts with the British intelligence services. He wouldn't deny it. Even before he was an MP, he used to go to Afghanistan. And, you know, he's definitely very, very close to those people. And he's definitely a spokesperson for them. But when I point, but I don't suppose he's going to face up to the fact that the Western intelligence services, which he presumably thinks are the good guys, are involved in all sorts of skullduggery as they have been. I'm not saying that the Russian intelligence services don't engage in skullduggery. That's another question. But the Western intelligence services definitely do.
Well, this
as
is
I mentioned, MH17 earlier.
Yeah.
The eyewitnesses on the ground, interviewed by BBC Russia, said they saw a plane from Kiev shoot it down.
And the pilot who's supposed to have piloted that Su-25. Committed suicide, apparently, earlier this year.
Now,
the
problem you've got in the West is that people don't believe that their intelligence services would be evil enough to kill peaceful demonstrators in Kiev in order to try and make the Russians look bad. But I'm afraid they are. They just are.
What we're talking about here is an international organised crime network, which the British intelligence services are very much a part. And one of the reasons I'm off to Holland next week, to the little town of Oosterbeek, next to Arnhem, is to do a talk down there about the Bilderberg Conference and the links to the 10 years before the Operation Market Garden, the Battle of Arnhem, where the British failed to end the war by Christmas. And there were all sorts of fascinating reasons why that battle failed, which I'll be talking about next week. But as part of all this, I think it's a good idea to have a chat to a former Swiss-German banker, Manfred Petrisch, who I interviewed recently. And he explained, I think, a lot about what's wrong with the financial system and the financial criminals in the Western world. What can you tell us about what's going to happen with the financial system? Because it does look certainly a bit shaky since 2008.
Shaky? That's understatement. The whole thing is such a huge bubble that can burst at any second. I mean, you see what happened at I predicted 2007, I predicted the 2008 because of the information I had at the time and also because I could count one and one is two. I mean, I could connect the dots and I saw that this was not sustainable. And then it actually happened with the Lehman Brothers crash and all the other things. And we have not learned a lesson from that. You see, what happened was is that banks were all bailed out and they pumped trillions of dollars into this whole system. We have this crazy situation that Mario Draghi, as head of the ECB, is pumping 80 billion euros into the market every month. Every month. And we have zero interest rates and even negative interest rates, like in Switzerland and in other countries, we have negative interest rates, and still the whole thing does not work.
Okay, so where are we heading then?
To a complete collapse. In a complete collapse of the financial system.
Would it be slow or sudden?
Well, it is happening already in slow motion right now. You know, it's not going to happen like a big crash and tomorrow you wake up and it's gone. It happens in slow motion. And I'm wondering anyway how they have been able to keep this system running for such a long time, because I thought it would have collapsed a long time ago. But since they're doing all these drastic steps, 80 billion euros every month into the system and negative rates. You see, they cannot keep up these negative rates and zero rates, because that means that all the pension funds, all those insurance, you know, life insurance companies, all those people who need interest because they promised this to their customers, like pension funds, life insurance, etc., they're going to go bust because they are not generating any interest with zero interest rates. So, well, how are they going to keep their promises? They can't. That means all the money in the pension funds and for retirement and all that is all going to disappear.
So is there any precedent for this in the past that we can learn from?
Not really, because you see, in the past, when I say past, I mean like in the 1920s, when the big Wall Street crash was and the big depression. You see, at that time, the difference is that we have these huge financial instruments, these huge, which were created, these artificial, which we call derivatives, you know, this huge derivative bubble, which has nothing to do with the real world. You see, what is happening in the financial area is that it's like a big casino where you're placing bets on everything. And I always have said, I don't understand why the financial system and the banks are not under the casino laws. Because where is the difference between betting on a horse and betting on an interest rate? There is no difference. You're betting. And that's what's happening all the time. They're betting on countries going bust, betting on companies going bust. They're betting on everything, on interest rates going up and down or whatever.
Is there anything positive coming out of all this? Do you think there's any kind of light at the end of the tunnel?
Well, what we see now with the Brexit, I think, is that people are realizing, because of also all the information which is on the internet, and if they read the newspapers or watch the BBC or watch any other television news service, is people have woken up. They have woken up that this whole system is just a big lie, and that the politicians are lying all the time, and the media is lying all the time, and that they are not being told the truth about everything, about why there are wars, why banks are crashing, why they are not earning more, why they are losing their jobs, and all these things.
Well, that's Manfred Petrisch from All Smoke and Mirrors blog. And I'll be looking next week at, I think, what I think is some of the origins in the Second World War of this massive international organised crime network that's at work today, most obviously in the West, undermining our political parties and also undermining the media, particularly buying up media that's critical of it and denuding it of decent investigative journalism, etc. So we'll move on now finally to Chris Busby. He's a radiation expert, and I spoke to him earlier today. He was arrested earlier this week. And let him tell his own story about what happened. Basically, the police decided that his laboratory, which he uses for writing scientific papers and court cases, was a bomb factory.
Well, I was in Wales working on my boat. I got a phone call from a police constable woman to say that they'd had a 999 call from somebody, but they wouldn't tell me who, that said that there was a woman at my house acting strangely. And they'd gone to see if everything was all right, she said, and the woman was in a bit of a state because she said that, you know, Chris hadn't come home and she was afraid he was ill or something, you know. So she called me up and said, did I know this woman? This is Ruth. She lives with me. She's a 30-year-old woman from Sweden, very beautiful woman, a little bit loopy. So I talked to Ruth and calmed her down, and then I thought that was the end of it. And then I thought I'd better come back and see if she's all right. So I got in the car, started driving back to Biddeford. I'm a long way, 5 hours. And I got a call from my daughter, Celia, who lives up the road in Torrington, to say that there were all sorts of police cars outside and big cordons and ambulances and goodness knows what. And she went down there to see what was happening, and they said that they'd ordered in the bomb squad and they'd taped the whole thing off and nobody was allowed in or out, and Ruth had to go away with Celia. So I came back to Celia's place because she told me Ruth's with her. And I went in there and talked to Ruth, and, you know, we sat down and two policemen came to the door, knocked on the door, came in and arrested me, put me in handcuffs and took me to Barnstaple police station, threw me in a cell. They said that they were arresting me under the Section 2. Of 1883 Explosives Act. So Section 2 says that you are in possession of materials capable of making a bomb, right? And then I talked to the duty solicitor when they got around to interviewing me. So, I mean, I was in a cell all night, in and out, being interviewed and, you know, interrogated. And he said that under this act, if you're found with materials that are capable of making bombs, so if you have substance A and substance B, and there is a way in which you can use substance A and substance B to make a bomb, then they're allowed to assume that you might be going to make a bomb and arrest you and charge you for having materials capable of making a bomb. The onus is on you to say that the reason you had those materials was something completely different and innocent, you see. Now, I've got lots and lots of chemicals here, mostly associated with my work on radiation, that were also associated on my research on the living systems. So I do a lot of research. I've done it all my life. I've always had a laboratory. The laboratory in South Wales for some time, in fact. But then I decided it was too far to go to do that work. So I brought that stuff back here and I put it in a room at the back of my house here. It's a big house. So that's the room that has these chemicals in there, you see. Well, the door was open, so they didn't break in. They just walked in. I talked to Ruthie about it, and she said she wasn't acting strangely. And the first thing she knew about it was the policeman came to the door, opened it, and walked in. And she doesn't know enough about the law to be able to say, hey, you can't walk in, who are you, and all that stuff.
OK, so what's your take, Chris, on what this is really about, then?
I'm engaged in two big court cases now relating to nuclear test veterans and a British submariner who died of leukemia, and I'm winning those cases. We tried to obtain information under the Freedom of Information Act in Scotland, and the judge said that he thought that we should have that information, and he backed up our request, and the MOD refused the request on the basis that the information we were asking, which was details of tests that they made on British submariners to see what radioactivity they had in their bodies, we wanted the details of that. They refused to give them on the grounds that it was a matter of state security, and it would affect the security of the United Kingdom to know what radionuclides there were in British submarine crew. So that's the first thing. The second thing is I'm doing another court case for a woman called Doris Butler, a test veteran whose husband died of pancreatic cancer. And I brought in two quite eminent experts, because they won't let me be an expert, so I'm being the representative. And the Secretary of State of Defense hasn't been able to bring in any experts that will oppose what my experts are saying, because nobody is now prepared to go into the witness box and be cross-examined by me, because I shall reduce them to ashes. So I'm in the process of destroying the Ministry of Defense position on radiation and health. That's the first thing. And the second thing is I've got four court cases now in America where I'm doing much the same thing. One with Stuart Smith and those people in St. Louis, Missouri, where there's a big radioactive landfill, and in Paducah, Kentucky, where there's a uranium plant. And the other one is, of course, the Ronald Reagan case, the sailors case, where they all went over to, help the people at Fukushima, and then now they're all dying of cancer. So my star is quite high in the heavens in terms of my scientific expertise and ability to take these b****s down.
Can I just ask you, why are you allowed to be an expert witness? You clearly are expert in your topic.
No. The Ministry of Defence took a court case against me in the High Court, in the upper tier, at the Royal Courts of Justice, said this guy can't be an expert because he's biased, because he believes a certain thing about radiation that makes him biased. He's not independent. And the judge agreed. And so the judge found that I wasn't allowed to be an expert, notwithstanding the fact that I've got more scientific research papers out than more or less anybody in this area. I believe that internal radioactivity, like uranium particles mainly, but strontium-90 and all that stuff, that gets pumped out of nuclear sites and is part of the fallout from Chernobyl and nuclear weapons and all the rest of it, that stuff is about 1,000 to 10,000 times more dangerous than the current risk model says. And I've written lots and lots of papers about this, and people are increasingly believing that, and people are coming to me for advice, and my outfit, which is European Radiation Risk, is increasingly being consulted rather than the current radiation risk model. I gave evidence to the Swedish Environmental Court last year, and they accepted the evidence, and they told the government they couldn't go ahead with their nuclear waste repository. That was in January of this last year, and I took the same evidence to London to talk to the British government minister, Harrington, but he refused to come. And so he wasn't there to have it, although, the committee had already agreed that they would hear my evidence, but they kept him away on some bogus pretext of a vote in the House, which there was no such vote. I looked afterwards. So basically, I'm piling on the pressure to these guys, and they got to get me. Well, they tried to get me with the Monbiot business in the Guardian. They tried to destroy my credibility over Fukushima, but basically that has gone away now. I had lots of interviews with them, and eventually persuaded them that there was no hope in hell that they would be able to stick anything on me on the basis of me having some chemicals, given that my name was Professor Dr. C. Busby written over the door, that they hadn't contacted me, that they'd gone in without a search warrant, and they're going to have to persuade a jury, because it's going to be a Crown Court, that I'm a bomb maker. I mean, I said, forget it. They discharged me. They gave me a note which said, no further action will be taken. Insufficient evidence to provide a realistic prospect of conviction.
Can you just talk about briefly about Fukushima?
Well, the consequences we know will be the same as the consequences after Chernobyl. So there will be an increase in genetic damage in the population affected. That will lead to, I calculate it, about 400,000 extra cancers in the next 50 years in the population within 200 kilometres, and a lot of dead babies. And a lot of leukemia, but we're not allowed to know any of this because the Japanese have put a complete embargo on any health data coming out of any of the systems in Japan. So nobody can find out what's going on.
What about contamination of the sea?
I think that it's not going to be as dangerous as people are saying. I mean, it will certainly affect the eastern seaboard of Japan very, very adversely, very seriously. But the Pacific is a very large mass of water, and by the time it gets diluted into the Pacific, I don't believe it will have a measurable effect. There'll be some effect, but it won't be catastrophic or apocalyptic or anything like that.
What's your take also on the Skripal case?
It was a false flag operation originally. It was all set up. I don't believe those two guys did it. I don't believe that it was done in the way they say it was done. There are all sorts of problems with it. For example, those guys got to Salisbury after the Skripals had left the house by 1 hour. Okay? So if you just have a look at the timing. So if they then went with their sort of supposed perfume bottle and sprayed the stuff on the handle, the Skripals had been away from there by 1 hour by then, and then they got ill, you know, after they'd been away. So there was no way that stuff that they supposedly sprayed on, well, they couldn't have sprayed it on the handles before the Skripals left the house because they weren't there.
So what would be the point in manufacturing a story like that?
Because the British are currently the American wing of NATO. The Europeans have more or less got fed up with spending huge amounts of money, so they made up NATO North and NATO South, and the British are basically NATO North. So they have to ratchet up all this argument about how the Russians are going to come over the border and eat babies and all that kind of stuff.
That's Chris Busby there speaking to me earlier today about all sorts of stuff, including his own experience with the police. Incredible. It's the sort of thing you expect might happen in China, an expert witness against the government. Anyway, time to sign off now for the Murdoch News at 8. You'll find this show's podcast story links and comment page at thisweekoneword.org.uk. I'm on Twitter at Tony Gosling. Do please join Mohammed for the politics show at 6 o'clock next week, as I'll be reporting from Arnhem. God bless, and don't let the banksters get you down.
Pacifica Radio, this is Voices of the Middle East and North Africa. I am Malihe Razazan. Khalil Bendib is away. This week, we speak with Ella Shohat, Professor of Cultural Studies and Women's Studies at CUNY, about her latest award-winning book on the Arab Jew, Palestine and Other Displacements. In her book, she gathers together her most influential political essays, interviews, speeches, testimonies, and memoirs, as well as previously unpublished material. Professor Shohat's text fundamentally challenges the conventional understanding of Arabs and Jews, Palestine, Zionism, and the Middle East. Professor Shohat spoke with Khalil Bendib.
So Ella, you're an Arab Jew from a Baghdadi family, now living in New York. In your most recent volume, this book, The Arab Jew, Palestine, and Other Displacements, you deconstruct any number of articles of faith of the Zionist propaganda and speak of the Jewish victims of Zionism, the Sephardim in Israel. You argue that the colonialist ideology of Zionism has not only affected the Palestinians, certainly, but also the majority of Israel's population, if you consider that there are more Sephardic Jews than Ashkenazi Jews. Tell us a little bit more about that.
The first essay included in the book from 1988, it was actually written in dialogue with an essay written by Edward Said. The essay that Edward Said wrote in the same journal in the first issue of Social Text was called Zionism from the Standpoint of Its Victims, and it became a chapter in his book, The Question of Palestine. When I became a member of the journal Social Text in the 80s, I wrote an essay that actually continued this argument, but this time bringing to the discussion a less known history and part of that history that was isolated and was not seen as part of the same problematic idea, on the one hand, colonialism in the region, imperialism and colonialism, on the other hand, Zionism and its relation to Palestine. And I wanted to broaden the discussion and extend the conversation in relation to the Arab Jews, which is why I, you know, named it in relation to Edward Said's essay. So this time, the assumption was that, yes, Palestinians have been the victims of Zionism, but let's now look at another dimension of the story. And it is a kind of a colonial story within the larger colonial story. Mm. And I started discussing what happened when Zionism arrives to the region. And I mean not only Palestine, but also the Middle East and North Africa in general, and how it affected the place of Arab Jews, Jews in the Middle East, who were now caught between, on the one hand, Jewish nationalism, and on the other, Arab nationalism, and in relation to the colonial discourses and practices in relation to Palestine. And it was important for me to show that it would have been impossible to think of Israel and what has happened without also addressing the Sephardi, Mizrahi, or the Arab-Jewish question, in terms of practices, in terms of ideology.
So if you count the Israeli Palestinians, who represent about 20% of Israel's total population, and then a little more than 50% of the Jewish Israeli population, which is Sephardic, we're talking about 70% of Israelis who are non-Ashkenaz and non-European. And if you include Gaza and the West Bank, we're way beyond those numbers. Why does this matter to you, the fact that it's so lopsided? Why is that an issue?
When I was writing the essay in the 80s, the proportion were actually even more so in terms of the majority. That's the kind of statistic that I'm speaking about reflected at the time. Since then, there have been more immigration from Russia, etc. So the numbers have changed. But the argument, to an extent, reflects a historical and political issue, which is we have a Eurocentric ideology that sees itself as an outpost. I mean, and this was already at the turn of the century, the way Herzl, the founding father of Zionism, in his book Altneuland, The Old New Land, imagined his idea of utopia in Palestine as European Jews bringing light and civilization to the wilderness. So for me, the very formation of the Zionist idea has to be seen in relation to other colonial discourses, especially the civilizing mission. Therefore, within Israel, Jews and Arabs have been completely separated. By looking at the problem through the colonialist history and through the imperialist narrative, I was able to reformulate the question of and the experience of the Mizrahim to give it a name, because there has been a lot of pain, a lot of about dislocation, a lot of injuries. that were psychic on the one hand, but also economic, political. People were kind of disoriented. What kind of explanation do you give to this phenomenon of being massively dislocated to the Arab world, arriving largely to Israel, and then being discriminated? What kind of understanding do we give it? So many sociologists, anthropologists in the 50s, in conjunction with various, say, the French and how the French spoke about Algerians, and they cite French sociologists, for example, or they cite American sociologists in relation to African Americans. And the idea is that we are inferiors because of the Levantine or the Arab primitive culture that we brought with us to Israel. That was the dominant way of explaining the discrimination and being at the bottom of the socioeconomic of Israeli society. But if we take another way of analyzing it, and that's what I was trying to do, we can completely understand it differently. Understand that already with colonialism, Jews in Muslim societies suffered, along with Muslims, discrimination, racism, but with the arrival of Zionism, they were suddenly redefined as Jews and were displaced and were lured often with messianic promises. So religious ideas were translated by Zionist discourse into ethno-nationalist ideas. And in that way, often Jews were lured. The other element was the tension and the war and the violence that was shaping around Palestine when Palestinians were becoming refugees and arriving to the Arab world. And that created a very vulnerable situation for Arab Jews. So this is a very problematic history, but the arrival to Israel meant that that history was erased, and the only way to think about the problem was, it was called the economic or the social gap between European Jews and Arab Jews. But if we take colonialism, we can fully understand that this is an ideology of so-called civilizing the primitives, and that had incredible negative impacts on Mizrahim Sephardim.
One of the things really struck me reading your book was I didn't realize how classical the racial hatred was. You say that they would often describe the Sephardim in zoological terms, and that Ashkenazi was resorting to the bestiary when describing them. You quote a Haaretz journalist saying, quote, "They put me in the same cage as a hysterical baboon, and they tell me, okay, now, you are together, so begin the dialogue. Speak to him nicely. Throw him a banana. You people are brothers." End of quote. What strikes me is all this talk of racial purity that obviously the Jews in Europe suffered from, that they would now use it against their own co-religion. This is really quite amazing to me. As if there's a race, an Ashkenazi race, as opposed to this other race of Sephardim. What is this idea of racial purity that we hear about in Israel?
Yeah, actually, this was written in the 80s. And this kind of language has not completely, unfortunately, disappeared. The kind of prejudicial language, the racist ideology that we often see in Israel, has to do with internalizing. There is a kind, I speak about this colonial specularity, the notion that Ashkenazim experienced racism in Europe, but internalized it.
Yeah.
And then in return came to project it onto their barbarian co-religionists. One can think about, even in the French equivalent of the civilizing mission, were the schooling system of the Alliance Française Israélite, which was implemented throughout the Levant. And the idea was that Jews will receive a good universal education. French Jews actually were part of the implementation of a universal, the notion, so-called universal idea. But this also continued in Israel. That type of internalization and the educational system within Israel was that because Arab culture is so inferior and seen in such a negative light, it has to be rejected. And therefore, anything associated with Arab so-called race, Arab culture, Arab physiognomy, Arabic language has to be rejected. And unfortunately, that's where I speak about the ordeals of civility, in which also Mizrahim, Arab Jews, ended up internalizing that type of ideology, that kind of discourse, in the very same way, ultimately, that all colonized people, and Frantz Fanon really elaborates and speak about it in a way that I found very useful for the Mizrahi situation, that Arab Jews themselves internalized this kind of perspective and started self-rejecting their own experiences, their own history, at least for several decades.
Yes, and there are so many quotes where racism is so blatant and so open. I didn't expect that even for the 50s. I mean, you know, the 50s things.
It continues.
It was the high age of colonialism still worldwide, certainly in Algeria. We were hearing similar things in Algeria from the French, but Jew on Jew, that's something that I didn't quite expect.
Yeah, that's why it was important for me to say that religious background is not sufficient to explain and speak about the situation of Arab Jews in Israel, because otherwise we won't have enough methodological tools to analyze the situation, which is why for a long time in this work I refused the notion of internal problem, internal Jewish problem versus external Arab problems. For me, the two issues are related. So the question of Palestine, therefore, is historically but also ideologically related to the question of the Arab Jew. Again, this is not to suggest that all Mizrahim would suddenly agree with my analysis or would see it through the same perspective. But this type of analysis tried to suggest that what happened among Jews is very much haunted by the colonial experience and by the very fact that within Israel, Euro-Israelis have come to see Jews from the Middle East in the very same way that colonialists so Arabs in the Arab world. There is no much separation or distinction. The only time that we have a complete kind of refusal to acknowledge it is when the Palestinian question emerges, and then the idea of Jewish nationalism comes to, in a sense, obscure the relationship between the racism toward Arab Jews and the racism toward Palestinian Arabs.
So many of these anecdotes that you write in your book also remind me of colonialism in Algeria, obviously. One thing that we always heard in Algeria from French people was how simple the locals, the indigenous Algerians were, and they were so easily satisfied with not much that they preferred actually to sleep on the floor than sleep in a bed. And this is something you describe as well. Yeah.
Right, right. Or in the case of the North African Jews, some of the anthropologists who were studying them were insisting that they lived in caves. They were cave dwellers. I mean, that became a very important idea of how Zionism rescues Jews not only from the Muslim oppression, but also from their own primitive culture. They borrowed the language of colonialist discourse. I mean, there is the erasure of Arab history, of Arab culture, of Arabic language was practiced exactly in the same way that was practiced in places like Algeria. Only here, there is a much more complicated narrative because we're speaking about the fact that Palestinians were dispossessed and now Arab Jews were arriving from other Arab countries. And they were even more vulnerable in the sense that they were no longer living in their own millennial places where they used to live. Being displaced added to their vulnerability vis-a-vis the establishment. And that kind of dependency, you know, we speak about in colonial situation on the dependency of the colonized on the colonizer, but this is even more so when you have situations of dislocation where your network, where your language, where your identity is shifting overnight with the massive dislocation from Arab countries. And now your Arab countries are the enemy of your current country. And in that situation, and that's why it was important for me not only to speak about the economic, the social, the political dimension, but also on the psychic dimension. Because without understanding how colonial violence inflict injuries on one's psyche, it would be hard also to understand the political positions that oppressed group end up taking, sometimes against their own interests or in denial of their own history and identity.
One myth that you take on, this narrative by Zionists, they try to portray the what's happened to the Palestinians and what's happened to the Mizrahi Jews as somehow balancing each other. That sure, we've been a little bit unfair to the Palestinians, but so have the Arab countries that are expelling these poor Jews that we are accepting here in Israel. Why does that not work, that symmetry?
I don't see it as an equation. I see the two issues, and in the introduction to the book, I actually dwell on it quite a bit, the relationship between what I call the question of the Arab Jew and the question of Palestine. The fact is that probably Arab Jews would have not been displaced and dislocated without the displacement of Palestinians. But why does dislocation happen? It is not an equation here. Palestinians, as they were displaced because of the partition of Palestine, the establishment of Israel, did not necessarily mean that Arab Jews would have to be displaced. Now, one can accuse Arab governments, and some Palestinians have actually seen Arab government as sometimes collaborating with colonial regimes and with the Israeli government, and some did, and that had negative consequences for Arab Jews. At the same time, one has to remember that that question and the fact that Zionism from the very beginning, when it wanted and needed, despite its racist attitudes, nonetheless needed Jews from Arab countries already dating back to the turn of the century, when it sent emissaries to Yemen, one very well-known Yavnieli, to bring Yemeni Jewish workers to so-called compete with the local Arabs. So from the very beginning of the implementation of what they called Hebrew work, it worked simultaneously in terms of taking lands, giving no rights to the fellahin, feeling threatened by the fellahin, who may want to work the land, the peasants, and therefore bringing Arab Jews and Jews from Yemen in this case, saying, and I cite, they wanted them precisely because they are Arabs in the form of Jews, they called them. So from the very beginning, the two issues work together. Certainly, when Israel is established and there is a demographic need, there are activists, there are Zionist activists in the Arab world who were creating sometimes tensions. Other times, they were luring Jews on false messianic ideas. So there were different reasons. So we cannot just call the problem of, on one level, one can call it Arab Jews as refugees. And I wouldn't even mind that, because people were displaced and dislocated in ways that is unlike immigration, because they could not go back for the most part. But what I find problematic in this narrative, when that question, and I think the question of the Arab Jew is now posed in relation to Palestinians to somehow suggest that Palestinians have no rights, no rights to make any claims for the land, for property, for any kind of a future in Palestine because Arab Jews were displaced. This is where the problem actually of this discourse emerges, when rather than seeing the two issues as related in opposition to one another, but rather they emerge in the semi-historical context, but they are not similar. In the case of Palestinians, it's a clear case of people who were dispossessed and had to leave and wish to return. In the case of Arab Jews, it's much more ambiguous. I'm not saying it is not a tragedy. I've lived this tragedy. It is a very painful tragedy. People lost a lot. They lost economically, politically. They lost identity. They have not been permitted even for many generations, actually, even to mourn that kind of dispossession. But one can speak about the dispossession and what happened and even criticize Arab regimes and how they contributed in very unfortunate way to our dispossession without saying that that should somehow suggest that Palestinians have no rights. Actually, we should address all the abuses and not suggest it's one at the expense of another. And unfortunately, I have critiqued some of the ways that those sites on Jews as refugees from Arab lands, for the most part, they never cared about Arab Jews or about Mizrahim. The only time we emerge as being cared about is only when we are used against Palestinian rights. I am trying to say not in my name.
When talking about one of the reasons, certainly one major reason why Arab Jews were brought to Israel, you make that one motivation is very clear by showing, quoting people like Yaakov Tahon of the Eretz Israel office to say, quote, since it is doubtful whether Ashkenazi Jews are talented for work other than in the city, there is a place for the Jews of the Orient, and particularly for the Yemenites and Persians, in the profession of agriculture. Like the Arabs, they are satisfied with very little. We're coming back to that idea again.
Yeah, I mean, they created a kind of an Orientalist narrative. How are you going to suggest the luring, as it were, of people who live in different spaces, countries? Whether it is intentional or not, it's not even important. What's important is the formation of an Orientalist perspective on Arab Jews that justified and allowed an uprooting of a whole population. This is a form of population engineering. In some of the essay, I call it the anomalies of the national and the colonial in the case of Zionism, because the anomalies is because usually the ethno-nationalist formation emerge on one particular land. I have problems with ethno-nationalist ideologies in general, but in this case, there is a certain kind of anomaly in which one can argue that the state created the nation and not the reverse. The state had to engineer the transplant of population from across the globe in order to create a new state. And hence, the erasure of that history, and especially in the case of Arab Jews, because Arab culture was the culture of the enemy. But by trying to suggest that Arab culture is inferior, you justify what happened to Palestinians, but you also justify what happened to Arab Jews. But the difference is that now Jews had to be cleansed of their Arab culture, de-Arabized, in order to be incorporated to the new nationalist Jewish project. And in that sense, the Arab Jew was no longer possible. And that's why I speak about the idea of the Arab Jew as a kind of becoming suddenly oxymoronic.
Exactly.
Be an Arab and a Jew was never a problem throughout millennia. But suddenly it emerges as a problem, which is why I call it the question of the Arab Jew. And the reason why I say it's a question, it is because, first of all, we have an ideology such as Zionism that tries to solve the problem of anti-Semitism by defining Jews as a nation and having this notion of restoration or repatriation. But again, did all Jews come from that place called the Land of Israel or Palestine? Even if we, say, support this argument, did this return mean that one has to push out and ethnically cleanse the land of Palestine from Palestinians? There are a lot of questions to be raised. So that's why it was important for me to link the two questions and then pose them within a larger framework of the massive dislocation that colonialism in general has generated. Because even if we look back to 1492 with the emergence of colonialism, with Columbus's arrival to the Americas, it wasn't just that the European arrived. And it wasn't just that they killed or massacred or committed genocide to the indigenous population. It is also that the population had to escape. People had, you know, communities were displaced, moved from one place to another. So this massive dislocations only was accelerated with the expansionism of 19th century. And in the case of the Middle East, it happened with Palestinians, and it happened with Arab Jews, and of course it happened with the post, what is came to be called post-colonial, or more precisely post-independence dislocations, where various communities, say from Algeria, had to move to France, or the fact that people had to be lured to France in the 50s, right, for economic purposes and to work in the new factories and with the expanding post-World War II economy.
That's Ella Shohad, professor of cultural studies and women's studies at CUNY, speaking with Khalil Bendib about her latest award-winning book on the Arab Jew, Palestine and Other Displacements. We'll hear more after a break. From Pacifica Radio, this is Voices of the Middle East and North Africa.
In Algeria was very similar. The Algerian Jews were assimilated into the French, or so-called French contingent. They became French over a few generations, and when France left, they found themselves leaving with the rest of the colonials. There was the same effort that we see today in Israel to bring anybody who's not indigenous. After a while, it didn't matter whether you were French or spoke French, we could make you French. Anybody was welcome as long as they were not Algerian. We're seeing the same thing today with the Palestinians. Russians, even non-Jewish Russians, can be turned Jewish, whatever. It's amazing how consistent some of these colonial mechanisms have been throughout the region.
I'll go back to your first point, which I address also in the introduction to the book. It is really fascinating what happened throughout the colonies, but especially the case of Algeria, you know, with the 1870 Crémier Decree.
Yes.
You can call it divide and rule policies in which various minorities, religious or ethnic minorities throughout the colonial world were privileged over the indigenous minorities were privileged over the indigenous majority in a way of creating or destabilizing the relationship. So the Crémier Decree was certainly one example, but here applied to Jews in Algeria who did not ask for it necessarily.
No, in the beginning they were resisting it. The Jews didn't, for a long time, were very shocked by this idea that somehow they could become French.
And they opposed it, actually.
Yeah.
And in fact, in the mountains, they did not even take that citizenship. So it gradually impacted the urban areas. But that process generated division between Muslims and Jews, which up to that point were seen as part of the same racialized, inferior indigenous people. But with this implementation of the kind of divide and conquer practices, Jews became citizens and then were privileged. And in that act, they were separated and were in a kind of an ambivalent zone. They were neither French, even though in terms of their citizenship, they had French citizenship, but in terms of their racial, cultural histories, they were not. But at the same time, they were no longer part of the Muslim indigenous population. They were placed in an in-between zone.
Yes.
And I think up to now, I would argue that we still live with the result of that in-between identity and history of being neither Europeans, of course, and neither completely Arabs the way the Muslims were. I mean, the case of Algeria is much more exaggerated. I mean, it was not the case in Iraq, for example. In fact, in Iraq or Lebanon, because you had a Christian minority, the Christians were more likely to be privileged over the Jews. I think it's more pronounced in North Africa in that kind of way. And in fact, one can argue that the tensions between indigenous Christian and Muslims during colonial times was much more pronounced than between Jews and Muslims in the Mashriq. But only with the arrival of Zionism, that balance started gradually to shift, and certainly completely shifted with the establishment of Israel. So my argument as a whole was that I do not see Zionism as rescuing us from our Muslim oppressors, but rather as generating new problems that were not there, at least not in that kind of way, prior to the arrival of Zionism.
Yes, and you quote some Palestinian leader in the beginning saying, we don't want our Jews to be separate. They're our brothers. They're indigenous people like us. And that, unfortunately, over time, changed quite rapidly. You also talk quite well about the economic dimension and how the chasm between the Ashkenaz who were already there and these new arrivals from Iraq, from Morocco. You say there were economic motivations for bringing them to Israel. The Russian Jews, for example, and people from the eastern part of Europe, were dreaming of going to America. They were not really interested in going to Palestine. It was hard to convince European Jews to come to Palestine.
Some actually, post-Holocaust, some European Jews, Holocaust survivors who did not want necessarily to go to Palestine or later Israel, sometimes were maneuvered to come there as well. But I think it was much more pronounced in the case of Arab Jews who had less control over their destiny, as it were. Once such secretive agreements were implemented, say, under the auspices of the British and with the Arab government that were appointed and were supported by the British, as in the case of Iraq, one cannot really speak about a choice. That's why I say the term, even the term, this is for me really the question of agency is important. The fact that they were later exploited within the Zionist project and that there was an economic interest in bringing them is crucial. At the same time, one has to understand and reflect on the question, why did they end up there in terms of did they actually want to go? And this is really important to understand that the question of agency, whether Arab Jews wanted to leave Iraq or wanted to leave Syria, was not really their choice for the most part. And if they did make that choice, often I would argue it was made on false premises. Something that was promised to them, and not only economically, may have been religiously, messianic ideas, or economic betterment, especially for poor Jews in various areas, that there will be an economic betterment. So the economy of once arriving to Israel and being turned into laborers was not the only problem. I mean, it went end in end with being categorized as inferior people with experiencing racism, while, and what I try to say, why it is not even the classical immigration of mobility, which happened in the case of, say, Eastern European Jews or any kind of immigration to another country, the idea of social mobility, economic mobility, ended up in reverse for the most part in the case of Arab Jews in Israel. You find kind of an anomalous situation in which educated Iraqi Jews had their children not even finish high school. That was a reversal of the situation, and where educated people became suddenly laborers.
You say the entire families of Yemenis were crowded into stables, pastures, windowless cellars, for which they were obliged to pay, or simply live in the fields.
Yeah, that was especially in the turn of the century. But that was also true in the 50s. I mean, people ended up living in tents. It was kind of a shock of arrival, arriving to a place, say some had, why I say it's false premises, because they believe that it would be a different situation, or that in the state of the Jews, as Jews, they would be privileged, or not privileged, or at least have different economic situation. So if we speak about the economic dimension, there was a shock when they arrived and had to live in tents in the fields. This is in the 50s. And then were mistreated, abused, their children sometimes kidnapped, suffered so-called radiation treatment for minor skin irritations such as ringworm. So all of those experiences cumulatively made most Mizrahim feel that they, at least up to the late 70s, I can certainly say that there was a feeling of alienation toward the state.
I will never forget the sequence in the film Forget Baghdad, in which you are quite a bit quoted there. You're in that film. That film, we see new arrivals from, I think, Baghdad, and these poor people are being sprayed DDT. They're spraying DDT on them as if they're carrying the worst pestilence and they're endangering the rest of the population.
Exactly. This is the whole notion of the Oriental body being pathologized and animalized. We come back to the zoological trope,
yes.
Right? We are carrying illness. You're just like an animal. That's why I'm saying it's not simply about the fact that educated people were suddenly sent to work in the fields that they were not used to and physically suffered and for minimal wages, but it is the humiliation, that kind of treatment that they did not expect. So I come back to the question where people say, well, they wanted to leave, they wanted to depart. But what is that agency? Again, we know clearly in the case of Palestinians that they did not want to leave. That's why I come back to the idea of for Arab Jews, there was a question why we can call it luring, because there were false premises on various level, including the economic dimension, but they did not know exactly to what they are leaving or departing from their countries of origins. The situation, because of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, was getting so scary. I'm not saying that Arab governments are not responsible for that, but I'm not reducing it to that question. But the shock of arrival and being in a new country that presumably is you're returning to your homeland, the land of the Jews, obviously did not materialize, and quite the reverse. So therefore, I'm kind of also trying to suggest that this notion of return to the homeland is highly problematic. First of all, Jews did not live that far from Palestine. Many of them often traveled from, say, from Iraq or Syria or Lebanon to Palestine, you know, and in the modern era, it wasn't a big deal to travel from Beirut to Haifa or take a train from Baghdad to Haifa, etc. So the notion that somehow Jews were separated if they wanted to worship for religious purposes or if they wanted to go there for businesses, that has existed. It existed in the past, but actually, in some ways, one can say this separation that came to exist with the partition of Palestine and establishment of Israel now was not possible. Now they had to choose for the first time in their history between the land of Israel as a religious place of worship and Arab countries, Arab places where they lived for millennia.
And against this idea, this questionable idea that somehow there's a Jewish race of some sort, the Ashkenaz, you quote Arthur Rupin saying, quote, recognizable about the Yemenis, recognizable in them is the touch of Arab blood. Right. And they have a very dark color. I mean, that's like the worst thing you can say. It's very dark. You even speak of eugenistic discourse when it came to describing Arab Jews, which is really highly ironic, considering that eugenism was used against the Ashkenaz in Europe.
And toward colonized people, of course.
Yeah.
So here again, we see how we cannot separate the Mizrahi Arab Jew question from the history of colonial discourse and the ironic twist of that history in which now they have been racialized by their own co-religionists. The notion of what is Jewish identity obviously is a crucial question. And here are the paradoxes. It's incredible because on the one hand, for the sake of making an argument about Jewish nation as an ethno-nationalist identity, the separation of the Jew from the Arab became crucial. But yet, for the sake of exploiting the racialist idea of the superiority of the European Jew over the Oriental Jew, for that explanation of inferiority and justification of their socioeconomic status, then the Arab or the Orient was now suddenly evoked in order to justify and explain the situation of Mizrahim in Israel. So you see the kind of contradiction between when one mobilizes the dominant ideology, mobilizes the Arabness of Jews in one case, and then erases it in another. That kind of, one can call it kind of a flexible usages of racialist discourses. And of course, in this new moment, or when someone of my generation reclaimed Arabness, when it was taboo, that's why I called another book of mine, Taboo Memories, Diasporic Voices, because the Arabness of the so-called enemy was such a taboo to reclaim. It could only use by the dominant ideology to justify our inferiority. But once we claim it as a part of our identity, part of our history, you'll see some essays attacking my work called Rejecting the Arab Jew. So it's fascinating to me that we come back to the question of agency. When we are denounced and we're called Arabs as inferior people and therefore married to be educated according to European norms, and then we're Arabs in the negative sense. When we reclaim it in the positive sense, there we cannot be an Arab. How could a Jew be an Arab? That's kind of only in the imaginary of some intellectuals, it is said. It
reminds me of Zinedine Zidane, who at some point, the Algerian French player who was the best soccer player and won the World Cup for France. They kept calling him a Berber because they liked him. They emphasized his Berber identity rather than Algerian to make a point that... To make a point, he's not an Arab, he's a Berber. But when he slipped and aggressed that Italian player who had baited him 4 years later, then they started calling him an Arab. He had devolved to the status of Arab.
It also takes us back to the point about the question of minorities in the Arab world that we talked about. We talked before about the Crémier Decree and the separation. The same thing was the Berber Decree, right? The separation of the Arab from the Berber.
They tried that less successfully, unfortunately for them, fortunately for everyone else. But
right,
it did leave a trace. There's still questions about...
The attempt, at least, to the divide and rule here was the attempt to separate the Berber or the Amazigh from the Arab. But the fact is that those identities have been mixed and have formed part of another. The same thing with, you know, the Jews as Berbers, Jews as Arab. It's not completely separable, those identities.
No, they are not, yeah.
But those kind of separations have been crucial, and they were kind of legalized. You know, by having those decrees, you actually implemented a certain kind of new reality that shifted a long history of how those communities negotiated their identities, how they practiced conflict resolution, right? Whether legally or culturally, suddenly a new grammar of negotiation entered the colonial space, a new language, and of course, a new kind of tensions emerge. So the discourses of minorities in the Arab world still exist with us, And this is not to say that everything was wonderfully harmonious before colonialism, but that kind of level of violence that was introduced and resulted in massive dislocation in the post-colonial or post-independence era has to still be understood vis-a-vis that imperial history.
Yes.
Whether it's so-called Berber, Jew, Kurds, Assyrians, etc.
The fragmentation of the quote-unquote enemy, fragmenting the opposition. To come back to the Sephardim, you quote, I don't know if she had said this, Golda Meir, who had also said that there was no such thing as Palestinian people. She actually said about the Sephardim, those who do not speak Yiddish are not Jews.
That's right. Yeah, that was a common perception, actually. Again, we come back to this question of those paradoxes. On the one hand, vis-a-vis the Palestinians, Sephardim are claimed as Jews. But then vis-a-vis the Ashkenazim, there is this ambivalent relation. But later, in order to generate a nationalist idea, this is actually part of my new work, which I touch a little at the last piece in the book. Now, the various languages that Jews spoke, and especially Arabic in the Arab world, was redefined as Judeo-Arabic, as if it is like Yiddish in relation to German. Just as Yiddish was no longer seen in, especially with the Yiddishist movement in the late 19th century, turn of the 20th century, they wanted to claim a certain status for Yiddish, not as a dialect of German, but as a language of its own. A similar process has happened over the past few decades in relation to various languages spoken by Jews, but especially vis-a-vis Arabic. Now, the Arabic spoken by Jews all over the Arab world, many different dialects, depends on the region, were now defined as Judeo-Arabic, and it is seen not as Arabic. I actually wrote 2 years ago in the Arab Studies Journal an essay called The Question of Judeo-Arabic, where I say that unlike the hyphen in the concept of the Arab Jew, which brings together the idea of the Arab and the Jew, often which have been since the partition of Palestine seen as separate ideas, the hyphen in the Judeo-Arabic actually separate the Arabic spoken by Jews from Arabic. I say, after all, Arabic is full of dialects. It's a heteroglossic language. But there is no such one language spoken by Jews in the Arab world. And there is no even such one dialect spoken as an Arabic dialect of the Jews in the Arab world. In fact, a Jew in Baghdad spoke Arabic closer to the Muslims of the region than that Jew spoke in relation to Moroccan in Fez. And similarly, a Jew and a Muslim in a city in Morocco spoke closer to each other. And some places, there was no distinction almost between, say, in Beirut. Class sometimes was much more of an operative category a religious difference or an ethnic difference. It varied. But the notion of the Judeo-Arabic, I have argued, also came to create a kind of a nationalist idea. So from a moment where Yiddish is defined as the true Jew really speak Yiddish, all other Jews are excluded from the category of Jewishness, it also suggests that the Ashkenazim have the power to define who's a Jew and who's not, and according to their criteria. But once an Arab Jew claims that Arabness, or say we spoke Arabic, which, you know, usually even once the Jews came to Israel, they were not allowed to speak Arabic. There was a serious taboo about you could not speak Arabic, you would be criticized, we're not an Arab country, you cannot speak Arabic. So when you have the only way to redefine that Arabic and legitimize it, was academically by calling it Judeo-Arabic, and the emergence of a new field called Judeo-Arabic language.
Yes.
Studies.
Which is stunning. In Algeria, there was the awareness that a few items of vocabulary were different or additional in Jewish parlance, but there was no real difference in language.
Just as you have certain words that came from Hebrew for religious practices, but also you have the traces of various languages depending on the region.
Yeah.
You know, in North Africa, you would have
Italian, you know, Spanish.
Italian, Spanish, etc. In Iraq, you would have the traces of Turkish and Farsi. All depending on the region, but no language is pure. And Arabic has been susceptible also to the various languages of the region in which Arabic has been spoken for millennia. I guess what I was criticizing is the fact that for the first time in our history, to be a Jew and to be an Arab were defined in opposition as antonyms. This is what I was writing in the 80s. I was trying actually to suggest, let's redefine that. It's not an oxymoronic identity, and it's not just about the past, but it's also about a way of rethinking and redefining the present of Jews still speaking Arabic. That has also changed, but also the fact that a future, and if even we speak about languages, I mean, the fact is that even with languages, one can revive languages, reclaim identities, one reshape identities. And there is nothing static about identities. Yeah. There is the politics of culture, yes, or language or culture. It's also, identity is not only what we are born into, it's also what we identify with. And that has to do with how we see the world, how we view history. And therefore, the question of the Arab Jew, it's about the past, but it's also about a certain kind of a critical utopia by looking into the past of, let's use the convivencia or the coexistence or living together of Jews, Muslim, Christians. It was not an impossibility.
The golden,
right,
age of Andalusia.
Exactly. But Andalusia, I'm trying to say, was not only in Andalusia. Andalusia was throughout the Muslim world.
Yes, yes, of course.
That kind of melange, mixing, cultural creativity was throughout the Arab Muslim world.
It's only so more famous because it's in Europe. It's, yes, again, that Eurocentric focus on things.
Exactly. But, you know, one can say Baghdad was a form of convivencia of Jews, Muslim, and Christians living together, creating, dialoguing. But rather than simply nostalgia for a past that could never return, I was hoping to formulate the Arab Jew also as a kind of a vehicle, as it were, to imagine another future.
Yes, of course. And I want to come back to that. It's a very important subject. I didn't know that even in the labor, Zionism excluded Yemenis and prevented them from owning land and joining cooperatives. This I didn't know. He said, as with Arab workers, the dominant socialist ideology did not provide any guarantee against ethnocentrism. How long did that last, that exclusion from these type of protections, labor protections?
Those examples were cited in the context of the turn of the 20th century.
Oh, okay.
When
so early on. Okay.
There was a mission to bring, and they brought about 10,000 Jews from Yemen.
Mm.
And that was the context in which the statement was made. But in fact, one can say that, unfortunately, for me, it was important at the time to write because it was still under years of labor hegemony. But this socialist formation that were at the same time colonialist and racialist coexisted. I was kind of deconstructing in a way the notion that socialism by definition necessarily is always already progressive, and to look in actually to explain why is it that what we call the left in Israel, or at least the Euro-Israeli Zionist left, has in many ways failed in its dialogue with Mizrahim and Arab Jews. And this is really unfortunate. So rather than try to have some kind of an essentialist notion about Mizrahim, Sephardim as Arab haters, which was the explanation at the time that Peace Now was giving for why Jews from Arab countries do not join Peace Now. But in fact, I was trying to show that throughout this history, many of the socialist leaders were unfortunately racist. apart from the fact that they also participated in colonialist practices, and did not imagine a full coexistence in the land of Palestine. So there was a question of Palestine that I find it is, after all, the socialist who practices colonization. On the other hand, it is also the socialist who were in power for at least up to 1977, who practiced exploitation and saw the Arab Jews through a racist lens. So therefore, the tensions and the conflicts between the workers, the Mizrahi workers, and the socialist government were there from the outset of the state.
Ella Shohat is a professor of cultural studies and women's studies at CUNY and the author of the award-winning book On the Arab Jew, Palestine and Other Displacements. She spoke with Khalil Bendib. From Pacifica Radio, this is Voices of the Middle East and North Africa.
That's it for us this week. Voices of the Middle East and North Africa is produced at KPFA Studios in Berkeley.
To get in touch, you can call us at 510-848-6767, extension 632, email vomekpfa@yahoo.com, connect with us on our Facebook at Voices of the Middle East and North Africa, or follow us on Vomina Radio. Please join us next time for another edition of Voices of the Middle East and North Africa.
Radio Free Radical. Coming up next,
PUC Radio.
TUC Radio, Time of Useful Consciousness. Arctic amplification, climate change and global warming, new challenges from the top of the world. Professor Peter Warams. The most important news for September that affects all of us wherever we live comes from the Arctic, but it's rarely covered. NBC4 and Tom Hartman were an exception.
Satellite imagery shows Arctic sea ice melting away to the second lowest level since records began in the late 1970s, creating more open ocean, which impacts global weather by adding heat and moisture for storms.
And welcome back. I'm very pleased to have on the line with us Professor Peter Warams. He's a professor of ocean physics, head of the Polar Ocean Physics Group at the Department of Applied Mathematics and Theoretical Physics at the University of Cambridge in the United Kingdom. You've written about an ice-free Arctic, the possibility. You predicted, the data has indicated, that within the next few years, the Arctic will be completely ice-free for the first time in over 100,000 years. What are the consequences of that, the people on this planet?
There's a whole series of consequences, which are all, unfortunately, rather serious. Firstly, the retreat of the sea ice, or the loss of the summer sea ice, will mean that global warming will increase because you're changing a large area of white to dark. So you're reducing the average albedo of the planet, and that will mean that it's absorbing more radiation in summer. Secondly, there's going to be an acceleration of sea level rise, because the warm air that's lying over this open water in the Arctic Ocean moves in over the island of Greenland and gives you surface melt of the Greenland ice sheet. We now found in 2012, for instance, that the entire surface of the Greenland ice sheet was starting to melt for a period in the summer, which is completely new. And this will mean that sea level rise will be accelerated because that meltwater runs off into the ocean. Possibly one of the most severe threats is the fact that the shallow waters off the Arctic coasts, especially the Siberian coasts, where there's very wide continental shelves with only about 50 to 100 metres of water depth, that water can warm up during the summer months. And this will give you positive temperatures on the seabed, which start to thaw out the seabed permafrost, which has been sitting there frozen since before the last ice age. This has never happened before, because the sea ice never retreated very much in summer, so the water temperature couldn't rise above zero. The warming water thaws the permafrost, and the permafrost is acting as a cap for a very large amount of methane, which is sitting in the sediments underneath in the form of methane hydrates. So you release the pressure by releasing that permafrost. This methane comes out as huge bubble plumes. That's already happening. It's been detected by scientists all over the Russian Arctic, most recently by a Swedish expedition, before that by various US-Russian expeditions. Each time they go, there's more and more bubbles, plumes coming out. And the fear is that there'll be a general release of methane trapped under those sediments, which could cause a very rapid rise in the rate of sea level. We calculated it could give you 0.6 of a degree warming of the planet in 5 years. So I think we must be really afraid of a methane pulse.
That was Professor Peter Wadhams on the Tom Hartmann Program in June 2016. And before that, a news clip from NBC4 of September 19, 2016. Peter Wadhams is the UK's most experienced sea ice scientist. He has made more than 50 expeditions to both polar regions, working from ice camps, icebreakers, and aircraft. He made 6 submerged voyages to the North Pole on Royal Navy submarines. Wadhams' research group in Cambridge has been the only UK group with the capacity to carry out field work on sea ice. With increasing urgency, Wadhams is calling attention to the melting sea ice of the Arctic. In his most recent book, A Farewell to Ice, he writes, "Our planet has changed color. Today from space, the top of the world in the northern summer looks blue instead of white. We have created an ocean where there was once an ice sheet. Polar ice is thinning and retreating with unprecedented speed. All our ingenuity cannot at present change that, because ice only grows in winter, but can melt year-round. Its growth rate is limited, while melt rate is unlimited." In a lecture in Milano, Italy, in May 2015, Peter Wadhams explained how the melting of the Arctic affects the rest of the world. There are very few scientists who so thoroughly understand the complexity of the climate system generated by the Arctic. Here's Professor Peter Wadhams in the first part of a one-hour lecture, Arctic Amplification, Climate Change and Global Warming, New Challenges from the top of the world.
Now, they've given me a very long title, so therefore I'm going to have to give a very long lecture. And there are three main elements. One is Arctic amplification, which is the fact that the Arctic is warming faster than any other part of the world. Climate change, how fast is warming happening throughout the world, and therefore how much faster is it happening in the Arctic? And then what are the impacts that Arctic change is having on the world? And I hope to show that many of the important changes that are happening globally actually come from rapid change happening in the Arctic. The Arctic is helping to drive the whole process of climate change in the world. So we start with the amplification question. And this is the fact that if we look at the Arctic, we find it's warming faster than any other part of the world. And we know that with every possible source of data, it's been possible to reconstruct the climate record for the last 1,000 years. And we find that the climate gradually was getting cooler. We were slowly moving towards a new ice age. It was warmer in 1,000 years ago, so the Vikings were able to settle in Greenland. And then it got colder until in the mid-19th century, it was a very cold time. Then suddenly the climate changed and it got warmer very, very rapidly. And that corresponded to the Industrial Revolution when we started burning coal, basically. And therefore we were putting carbon dioxide into the atmosphere from coal burning, and that started the whole process of man-induced global warming, anthropogenic warming. Well, if you look at the climate curve for the Arctic, this is all the stations north of 60 degrees, between 60 and 90, we find there's the same pattern as the rest of the world. But if we look at the scale, we find that the total amount of warming in the Arctic over that whole period has been something like 3 degrees. But if we look back at the world, we see the total amount of warming is only 0.8 of a degree. So the Arctic has followed the same pattern of warming as the rest of the world, but there's been much more warming, about 3 or 4 times as much. So that's Arctic amplification. When we compare all the stations, all the weather stations in the world, we find that the warming that's happened since the mid-20th century is very much greater in high northern latitudes than in over the world as a whole on average. So if we look at where that heating is concentrated, we find that the greatest warming is happening in the western part of the Arctic Ocean and in northern Baffin Bay. These are parts of the ocean which I'll show are actually ice-free now in the summer and didn't used to be. So the fact that there's open water there instead of ice means that the weather warms up. There's warmer air over the water because there isn't any ice on it. So the greatest warming is in parts of the Arctic where there used to be sea ice, but now there isn't. Now, in the planet as a whole, this is what's happened in the last few years. There's been some indication that the heating has flattened off, and this has been a kind of gift to people who don't believe in climate change. They think, well, nothing's happening because in the last 10 years, that the average temperature of the Earth hasn't gone up. But the amount of heating of the Earth has increased. The Arctic has continued to heat up very fast, and there is extra heat going into the planet, but instead of warming air temperatures, at the moment it's all being absorbed in the ocean and heating up the deep ocean, especially the Pacific Ocean. So if we look at this Arctic amplification and project it into the future, with climate models, we can see that the heat is going to be concentrated in the Arctic. We expect by the end of the century perhaps 7 degrees of warming, 7 to 8 degrees in the Arctic, and 3 to 4 degrees in the rest of the planet, which is still a lot, with, again, the big Arctic amplification. Now, let's look at climate change in the world as a whole. The two terms climate change and global warming are used interchangeably, but in fact we should really use the word climate change when we talk about natural changes that are happening due to all kinds of natural causes, and global warming to the specific change that's happening because of the carbon dioxide and other gases that we put into the atmosphere. So climate change is ice ages. That's because that's natural. And this is a record of temperatures over the last 400,000 years from ice cores drilled down through the Greenland and Antarctic ice caps. And we see that the Earth has passed through a cycle of extremely warm and extremely cold conditions. That's the ice ages and the interglacials, which are the periods in between. So we've had this kind of sawtooth pattern where we emerged from an ice age about 12,000 years ago, and we're up here now in the warm interglacial. But before that, we were deep in an ice age, about 4 degrees colder than we are now. And that was a gradual decrease of temperature from the previous interglacial, which we emerged from another ice age. So we have this pattern of sawtooth, which is actually due to astronomical factors. It's because the Earth's orbit has a slight wobble on it, and that alters the amount of radiation received by the northern hemisphere and the southern hemisphere. So it's a natural phenomenon which causes glaciers to advance, give us an ice age, and then retreat, and we come out of the ice age. So if we allowed nature to take its course, we've come out of an ice age and we would be gradually sinking towards the next one. But we stop sinking towards the next one. In fact, we're warming up. So this natural change is accompanied by a natural change in the carbon dioxide content of the atmosphere. When there's a lot of glaciers around and there's not many plants growing, then there's less carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. So there are natural limits to carbon dioxide levels between 180 and 270 parts per million. Nature would prefer us to be in this range of carbon dioxide levels. But now we look at what we've done at the end of last century and the 19th century, it's shot up and now it's over 400. So we've never had carbon dioxide levels as high as we have now, and it's entirely due to us burning coal and then oil. We've done this to our climate, but we've added this huge amount of carbon dioxide to the atmosphere, and we've added a lot of other gases also which cause greenhouse warming, nitrous oxide and methane. These are two other climate gases which both cause global warming and which have increased because of industrialization, methane from natural gas and nitrous oxide from industrial processes. So we've done that, and we're still doing it. There's for everything that you've heard about various global leaders promising to reduce carbon emissions is completely false. They've promised, but nobody's actually done anything. And the rate of increase of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere continues to increase exponentially. There's absolutely no evidence of any leveling off or reduction in carbon dioxide emissions by mankind. We really are addicted to burning things and producing carbon dioxide. So today, this is the present levels of carbon dioxide emissions. And we can see that in Europe, we can, and in the USA, we can feel all virtuous because Europe's gone down recently. And this is a bigger range of European countries. We've gone down. The USA has gone down slightly. But you can see that that's done at the cost of China and India rising very fast. It's essentially we've given over our dirty manufacturing industries to China and India, and they do all the nasty things with factories producing things, and so they emit the carbon dioxide, and we can feel virtuous that we're not. But if you add it all together, because carbon dioxide has no nationality, it spreads throughout the world, the planet is increasing in carbon dioxide level still exponentially. The way we think about what it does to the climate is called radiative forcing. That is, the greenhouse gases, which actually are preventing the Earth from emitting long-wave radiation. So the Earth wants to emit radiation due to its own temperature, but the radiation can't get out because of the gases that are in the atmosphere that hold it back. So that restraint on emissions is as if we were adding to the solar radiation. It's as if we were warming the Earth more by adding solar radiation. So we think of it as radiative forcing. So these are then enables us to measure what the different gases do. And the biggest greenhouse gas is carbon dioxide. Methane is coming along behind, about a quarter as much as carbon dioxide. Nitrous oxide and halocarbons, that's the gases from air conditioning systems. So these are the big emitters. We're getting a little bit of radiative cooling from aerosols, that's the dirty stuff we put into the atmosphere, and that helps to compensate a bit, but on the whole we have a large amount of positive radiative forcing, which is what's warming the planet. So that's global warming as opposed to climate change, which is natural. This is unnatural. So now I'm going to talk about what Arctic warming is doing to the planet and what its impacts are. And there are seven different kinds of impacts that I've identified, so I'm going to go through all seven. The first one is the sea ice retreat. That is, sea ice is retreating in the Arctic, and that's changing the albedo of the planet. That's changing the amount of radiation that's reflected back into space, because you're replacing a white surface by a dark surface. Then, secondly, that the ice, because it's getting thinner and changing its nature, that's accelerating the retreat. So that's the second one. The third is that the warmed air over the Arctic is causing the Greenland ice sheet to melt more rapidly, and that's causing an acceleration in global sea level rise. Then the fourth one is that snow line, that's the area of snow in the Northern Hemisphere, has been going down as well very rapidly, and that in itself increases the albedo feedback. Then the fifth one is that there's a direct threat, which really does threaten our well-being at this moment, which is the threat from the emission of methane from offshore waters of the Arctic. And this is a problem we're looking at the moment. It's a very, very serious one. The sixth one is that the retreat of sea ice is causing extreme weather events, which we've all been experiencing the last two or three years. And that has an impact on global food production. That's also very, very serious. And finally, there's a decline, leave the good news till the end, there's a decline in the strength of the Arctic thermohaline circulation. I'll explain what that is later. It's the ocean circulation in the Atlantic, and the retreat of sea ice is causing changes there which are actually cooling Europe, but cooling mainly countries like Britain and not Central Europe. But they're not actually cooling Europe, but it's reducing the rate of warming of Europe. So that's, in a sense, it's good news for Europe, but bad news for the Gulf of Mexico, because that's warming up more rapidly. So let's look first at the sea ice retreat, number one, and then the associated question of the thinning of sea ice. Sea ice retreat was first noticed in about 1950, and until about 1950, it was difficult to measure anyway, because you had no instruments. You depended on sailors sailing around the ice edge, catching seals and whales, and saying where the ice edge was. And then from 1950 onwards, we started to have aerial surveys. And then from 1970s onwards, we had satellites. So our knowledge has got better and better. And we find that at all times of year, the Arctic sea ice has been retreating since about 1950. But the most rapid retreat has been in the summer months. That's July to September, and that's because the ice in the Arctic Ocean fills the Arctic Ocean round to the coastlines of Alaska and Siberia, and it's easier to see a retreat because in summer the sea ice falls back from those coastlines and leaves some open water around the edges, so we can see it better in the summer. Starting 2005, in a typical summer, the ice fills nearly the whole Arctic basin. In winter, the ice covers the whole Arctic Ocean right up to the coastlines of Siberia and Alaska and Canada. But in the summer, it retreats a little bit. So if you're very brave and you can try and sail an icebreaker through the Northern Sea Route, that's this route around the north of Siberia, or the Northwest Passage, which is the sea route around from Baffin Bay across the north of Canada. but you have to be lucky and you have a lot of ice. But then in 2005, the ice started to retreat from that limit and we had more open water. Then in 2007, there was a much bigger retreat. A whole big chunk was taken out of the Arctic Ocean, giving you a big blue sea at the top end of the world, which was never there before. So this big area became ice-free. Then in 2012, there was an even bigger retreat, and this is the record so far. So it lies even further back. There's an even bigger area of open water in this part of the Arctic Ocean, which is called the Beaufort Sea, and less ice all round. So in only a decade, we've gone from the summer ice. Summer in the Arctic means September, because that's when there's least ice. Gone from summer ice filling the whole Arctic Ocean still to summer ice only filling less than half of the Arctic Ocean. But this wasn't matched by climate models. The sort of official view of what's happening to climate is given by the periodic assessments by the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, but they make use of computer models of climate change, which on the whole, for the planet as a whole, work quite well, but they don't work for the Arctic. These are the models gave you gradually diminishing through this coming century to 2100 here. But what's actually happened is we've already got that amount of decrease by 2012. So the reality has been the ice has been collapsing, the ice area in summer has been falling away really fast. Then what does that mean in terms of changes to global warming? Well, there was a study done last year in the University of California where they looked at the loss of ice between summer now and summer 20 years ago and looked at what that does to this thing called global albedo. Albedo is the fraction of solar radiation falling on the surface of the Earth that's reflectedly out into space because the surface is bright or white. So a white surface, freshly fallen snow, has an albedo of about 90%. 90% of the solar radiation is reflected straight back into space. But open sea or land or forest has an albedo of less than 10%. So 90% of the radiation is absorbed. And the effect of this sea ice retreat in the Arctic alone, according to the calculations of these people at the University of California, has been to reduce the average albedo of the Earth from 52% to 48%. And it's the same as adding a quarter to the amount of heating of the planet due to greenhouse gases. But even that model doesn't take account of is the fact that the ice has been getting thinner and changing its character. So first of all, there's ice that's more than a year old. It's called multi-year ice. It's very thick, rugged kind of ice. But this last decade, the area of multi-year ice has gone right down. So nearly all the ice in the Arctic is now young ice, ice called first-year ice that's less than a year old. That's a huge change in the character of the ice in the Arctic. And we've been following the thickness changes by going underneath the ice with submarines and British Navy submarines, and the US has been doing the same, and measuring the thickness of the ice from below. If you look at the Arctic as a whole and look at all the data, including the US data, there's been a thinning of between 40 and 50%. As not only is the ice smaller in area, but it's only half as thick as it used to be. So if we include the effect of the change in ice characteristics, the change in age, and multiply that by the change in area, we get a change in volume. And the volume change is a much more rapid decrease than the area change. The ice is shrinking, but as well as shrinking, it's getting thinner. And if you combine the shrinking of area and the thinning of the ice, the amount left is much less. So the amount that's there in the summer now is a quarter of what it was in the 1980s. Maybe in only 2 or 3 years' time, there won't be any ice in the Arctic in September. There'll be ice all the rest of the year, but in September, there'll be a disappearance. And the way this has been represented is this thing called the Arctic death spiral, which is that you take a graph where the distance from the centre is the amount of the volume of ice at different months of the year. So September of 1979, there was this much. And if you go then forward in time to now, the volume goes right down until it's here, less than a quarter as much as there was in 1980. And every other month of the year, these are all the other months, the ice volume also goes down. But September is the month where it will disappear first, and then perhaps August and October. And then the winter months, the ice will stay longer, a few more decades, but it will still eventually go. It's decreasing both in area and in thickness. So that's something we should worry about.
That was part one of a one-hour talk by Professor Peter Wadhams on Arctic amplification, climate change and global warming, new challenges from the top of the world. He spoke in Milano, Italy, on May 29, 2015. Peter Wadhams is the UK's most experienced sea ice scientist and was professor of ocean physics at Cambridge from 1992 to 2015. He has made more than 50 expeditions to both polar regions. His most recent book is A Farewell to Ice. Come back when TUC Radio returns to hear Professor Wadhams talk about methane emissions, ocean currents, and more. You can hear this program again for free on TUC Radio's website, tucradio.org. Look for the newest programs page. TUC Radio's free and depends on the support of listeners like you. Your donation keeps this program on the air. Go to TUC Radio's website, tucradio.org. There you can also subscribe to weekly free podcasts. My name is Maria Gelarden. Thank you for listening.
We're back here in Unusual Sources, 93.3 CFM-UFM, broadcasting to Hamilton at 93.3 on the FM dial and via our live streaming website at cfmu.ca. That's cfmu.ca. You can listen to us right now. So if you have friends out of town who want to hear, say, our interview with Eve Engler, you can just tune in at cfmu.ca. It's live streaming and it will be archived right there on the website. So I do believe we are joined by Canadian journalist, author, and someone who's coming to Hamilton shortly, Eve Engler. Eve, thanks for being on the program with us today.
Thanks for having me, Ben.
Well, it's not the first time. Must be at least a 10th time. Actually, it's the 10th time you've come to Hamilton and much more than the 10th time you've been on this program. You're one of our long-running favorite guests. And before I say anything else, let me point out this book. It's Left Right, Marching to the Beat of Imperial Canada's Foreign Policy. It's going to be launching here in Hamilton on Monday, September 24th at 7 o'clock p.m. at a location that's familiar to many of our listeners, the New Vision United Church. That's Monday, September 24th, 7 o'clock p.m. at the New Vision United Church. Admission is free. It's also going to be, I hear Eve's is going to be at McMaster here right at Mac at 12:30 p.m. that same day, but the room is not yet determined. We'll let you know. Admission is free for both events. You can talk to Eve, get a copy of the book, which I strongly encourage people to do, because this is easily one of the most interesting books we've had come our way in a long time. Look, it's your 10th book, Eve, and it really shows. I'd say it's a mature work. It relates to what you have done as an activist personally, and it ties into your other books about the propaganda system in Canada, about Canada and Haiti, about Canada and Palestine, and numerous other topics. And, you know, it kind of makes me wonder, would you say that your experience as an activist, like working with the Haiti Action Network, do you think it's helped you understand the issues in this book?
for sure. I mean, there's a number of personal stories from engaging with the NDP on the question of Haiti to engaging with Paul Dewar, the former foreign critic for the NDP, and seeing that, you know, this is not just a question of lack of information, but it's a question of often very conscious not wanting to hear information that goes against what's in the dominant media and what is easy to sort of go along with. The activism engaging on a whole bunch of different international solidarity issues is definitely informs this book.
Right. Now, for those listeners who might not know a lot about the book, of course, it is about the failure of the institutional left in Canada to oppose empire. That is to say, Canadian imperialism, militarism, involvement in the empires, whether it's British or American. It's the failure to throw off colonial attitudes and to engage with the peoples of the world from the perspective of the oppressed and oppose our own capitalist class. So what Eve is doing in this book, which again is called Left Right, Marching to the Beat of Imperial Canada's Foreign Policy, is he's looking at four main areas of Canada's institutional left. The Social Democratic Party, or parties in English Canada, looking at the NDP, which you've just mentioned, labor unions, organized labor, think tanks, left-wing think tanks, and public intellectuals, prominent people writing in newspapers and commenting on TV as public intellectuals. And, you know, Eve, you were just alluding to this. We have a propaganda system in this country and in most other countries. You have written a book about the propaganda system in Canada and how it manufactures consent for Canadian interventions and militarism and things like that. And in the introduction to this book, you talk about how this propaganda system in Canada, is largely responsible for why Canadians acquiesce to our government's foreign policy, even when it involves invasions and bombing countries and destabilizing countries and so on. We're taught that it's the right thing to do. There's this huge network of media and think tanks and so on that build consent to have us support that. But you also say in the introduction that the other part of why this sort of thing is allowed to happen without much or any resistance is because the people that are supposed to be protecting us from empire and capitalism and so on, that is our institutional left, they often, in so many cases, do not challenge this and often believe in myths that support it. You mentioned the NDP there, and that's interesting to us here. In anti-war activism, we engage with a lot of organizations, from labor unions to media to the NDP, and we've done lobbying and work in the NDP to try to get them to adopt better foreign policy positions. And it's a tense battleground. And I was just absolutely fascinated by the early chapters of your book because I was there and many people I know were there for parts of that. When you talked about how you and others were part of the Haiti, you know, delegation in the NDP talking about what Canada's role there was and what we should do about it. And I was present for that. And at the Afghanistan conference policy convention in 2006 a number of the Palestine related meetings and such. And so I can vouch for a lot of what you're saying personally. The NDP is important. It shapes domestic policy and foreign policy to an extent, shapes consciousness among the left-wing people here. So your analysis was fascinating. You took a deep look at the NDP going back to when it was founded as the Cooperative Commonwealth Federation, the CCF. You kind of wanted to know what happened. Where did it start out? How did it get to where it was? So, you know, it seemed to me things started out well enough. I was wondering if you could tell us about the CCF's founding document there, the Regina Manifesto, because it kind of talked about imperialism and the dangers of capitalism, and that seemed to be the sensibility of the party at first. So, you know, how did it start out? I mean, they were kind of skeptical of foreign intervention and great wars and the empire, weren't they?
Yeah, early on, the CCF, the Regina Manifesto, and a number of other sort of documents that influenced the founding, they certainly criticize capitalism. They refer to imperialism a few times. There's calls, you know, there's peace calls. I think that the even on foreign policy, certainly on domestic policy, but even on foreign policy would be much more internationalist than what the NDP would produce as a document today. But there was still a downgrading of foreign policy issues, but it's really with World War II and the aftermath of World War II that the CCF goes into a decidedly pro empire direction, and immediately after World War II supports the Marshall Plan, supports the establishment of NATO, supports the war in Korea. In fact, cheerleads the war in Korea, where even is out and ahead of the government and calling for Canadian ground troops in 1950. So they take this position that is very much about, this is what these endeavors, Marshall Plan, NATO, are about really sort of restructuring the world geopolitics to the whims of Washington and Canada. Lester Pearson and Canadian officials are quite significant players in this. And the CCF really endorses this wholeheartedly. They endorse things like the British campaign against nationalizing oil in Iran. Even though they're calling for nationalizing lots of elements of Canadian economic life, and they pursue this policy aggressively, and they also pursue it against the desires of much of the membership, or that's at least not clear. What's clear is that they try to suppress efforts by the membership to, for instance, debate the Korean War in 1950. So just before the convention in August of 1950 in Vancouver, the Executive Council comes out with a statement strongly in support of the war effort, basically making it impossible for the convention to debate, for the members to debate the issue in the coming days. When members are pushing things like the Stockholm a petition to ban nuclear weapons, they work to undermine any connection between CCF activists and the Canadian Peace Congress, which was pushing the Stockholm petition to ban nuclear weapons. They dub it a front for communism. A whole series of measures. They even kick people out of the party. Fairly prominent people in Manitoba out of the party for their activism opposing NATO, opposing the Marshall Plan. So there's this strong alignment with sort of post World War II Cold War militarism, Western foreign policy that is pursued in a way that's anti-democratic within the party.
Yes, the CCF originally, it seemed, domestically and on foreign policy, to be more radical than the later NDP. And there's also a story you can tease out here, which you can see in the pages of your book, which is that there's often the base or the membership or grassroots of the CCF-NDP are often more skeptical about war and interventions and things like that. And the leadership comes in and suppresses them and says, no, we're going to do things this way. And you mentioned the Cold War period after World War II. That's when it really ratchets up. And they're coming in and just giving the sort of NATO line on everything from the top leadership downwards. I think there was even talk of bringing Bevin from the UK. He wanted to speak, or he could speak in Canada. The membership wanted it. The leadership didn't seem enthusiastic about allowing that great socialist from the UK to speak in Canada. So they're taking direction even still from Britain on foreign policy after World War II. And as you pointed out, the NDP, the CCF are opposing countries like Iran that are trying to nationalize their resources while we might support it here. So, what's good for us isn't good for them. That's a policy we see continued later on. So I'm glad you mentioned that. So if we move ahead, skip ahead to more modern times that we might be more familiar with, we're looking perhaps at Haiti and Palestine, because again, like many other anti-war or anti-imperial policies from the old CCF days, the CCF's original position on Palestine, it wasn't so bad when it started out. They were kind of skeptical of Zionism as a right-wing phenomenon. And that seemed to change, though, too, didn't it? I mean, as time went on, the skepticism dissipated.
For sure. I mean, the J.S. Whitworth, the head of the CCF, is critical of Zionism in the late 30s. And the NDP, or the CCF convention, even refuses to endorse Zionism. I believe it's in 1942, still refuses to endorse Zionism. And they, Woodworth talks about it being, you know, sort of why pick on the Arabs except for alignment with British Empire. He states that. So it was understood that this was this was the Balfour Declaration, and this was an outgrowth. Zionism was very much an outgrowth of British imperial policy at the time. So there's this skepticism, but that changes fairly quickly with the creation of Israel, and then 1948, and then the party becomes very much in favor of Israeli policy and defending even like weapon sales in the mid 50s to Israel, denying Palestinians' existence into late 60s, 70s, and continuing on to today. I mean, it's sort of been ebbed and flowed a little bit based upon recent leadership. But I think the question of Palestine is one where up to today, you had, someone like Tom Walker, who was a staunch supporter of Israel. But you have the base of the party that has gone in a completely different direction, and the base of the party is very much in favor of Palestinian rights. And the NDP is willing to go to quite extreme lengths to block the base of the party's voice to be heard. And, there's three conventions that I discuss in the book over the past 12 years or so, where the leadership has worked to suppress resolutions standing in solidarity with Palestinians. The most extreme example was at the recent convention, which probably some listeners are familiar with, where there's this Palestine resolution that's the most widely adopted foreign policy resolution, second most widely adopted resolution by local riding associations in the lead up to the convention, in of any resolution in the whole thing on any different issue. And they bury the resolution way down, so making it impossible to discuss it. And when there's an attempt to change the order of what will be discussed on the actual convention floor, they pull all kinds of shenanigans, bring in all the flacks within the party, all the leadership, all the MPs are there early in the morning to vote down this attempt to actually have a discussion about this very widely supported resolution.
Yes.
And this is not just only on Palestine, as you could have alluded to. There's another example of that on Haiti in 2006. This is a somewhat of a recurring theme where when there is a push from below on to be critical of elements of Canadian foreign policy, it's almost always in battle with the leadership, and very rarely does the leadership actually support it. And in fact, often they pull different kind of maneuvers to block it.
Yeah, for those who don't know, of course, there was that recent policy convention in the NDP that Eve was referring to, and we actually had a gentleman who had been present at that, Henry Evans Tenbrink, and Doug Brown, our co-host, was there too, I think, and they talked about on the program exactly what you're referring to there. There was a big push, and that's the word I would have used, a big push by the grassroots to finally get the NDP to adopt more openly pro-Palestine positions, recognizing the occupation and that Canada's position on this has been unfair and lopsided and so on, and to address these problems. And a lot of enthusiasm, young people there, and There's video of the convention. You can see people lined up with signs, you know, at the conference debate. And everyone is, there's a lot of energy, and they thought they just might pass it, but they were just barely defeated. As you said, they used a lot of administrative tools to keep that resolution low on the list and things like that, delay it, block it, and bring in party functionaries and so on to stall and whatever. There is this base versus leadership issue in the party. Now, for those who are just tuning in, of course, we are speaking with Eve Engler about his brand new book, which is not launched yet. It's launching in a couple weeks. It's called Left Right, Marching to the Beat of Imperial Canada's Foreign Policy. And you'll be able to pick up a copy in Hamilton when Eve presents the book. And yes, Eve's the Haiti thing, I mean, you know, you were there, I was there. And it was the same kind of struggle. And Afghanistan, too, the 2006 policy convention, the membership got the NDP to adopt, maybe become the first party in the English-speaking world, the first party with elected members to call for withdrawal from Afghanistan. And you look at how the NDP walked away, backed away from that over time, even though it got them a lot of attention and support from parts of the country. So they're scared of their own shadow sometimes. But now the Cold War is back, right? Not just Afghanistan and the War on Terror and all that, but we got the Cold War. There's Ukraine, and it looks like the NDP is trying to show it's the number one anti-Russia promoter, and it's very gung-ho about Canadian involvement in Ukraine. Probably a far cry from what the early CCF grassroots would have supported. There's even support for Ukraine's far right now. What can you tell us about that?
Yeah, I mean, the NDP foreign critic Elena Vadier has supported Canadian Canadian military training in Ukraine, has supported. There's these examples where MPs have marched at rallies, Canadian rallies in Toronto, for instance, where march with groups from the right sector, even actually NDP MP shared a stage with a spokesperson from the right sector. Right sector is this, you know, far right sort of fascistic group within the Ukraine, has, you know, the tied into the whole history of anti-Semitic fascism in Ukraine. And NDP endorsing, I mean, going to the point of even calling for a liquor control board to ban Russian wines, or sort of Russian vodkas in Canadian liquor stores. NDP party both in Alberta that pursued that and in Manitoba. And so taking this really just extreme supporting Canadian troop buildup in Latvia, right? There's 450 Canadian troops in Latvia, all part of this anti-Russian kind of hysteria, something that obviously justifies militarism, justifies, you know, military spending increases. And the NDP has, you know, aligned with that policy, and it's overwhelmingly what shapes NDP foreign policy today is basically what appears in the Globe and Mail and on CTV. They follow the dominant media on foreign policy. So if the dominant media is saying the bad guys are so and so in Kiev, then that's what the NDP follows along with, unless there's a grassroots push going in a different direction. And so you see, you know, from the Ukraine to Venezuela, right? Venezuela, in recent years, the NDP has really gone along, Elena Vadier specifically, has gone along with this efforts to destabilize the elected government in Venezuela, sometimes even criticizing Stephen Harper from the right on the question of Venezuela. Take a look at Syria and, you know, something like the White Helmets, the NDP very much supporting the Canadian funding of the White Helmets, of the tour of White Helmets in Canada. So the NDP foreign policy very much still is very much motivated, pushed by what appears in the dominant media, and that's just that what appears in the dominant media is basically what the people at the State Department and the CIA want Canadians and Americans to hear about.
Well, yeah, it ties into your broader analysis. I mean, on the one hand, the NDP is sort of a follower party rather than a leader party on foreign policy. At one time, it might have been a leader on foreign policy, but now it gets its ideas from CNN and the mainstream news and so on about what countries are bad and what regimes need to be changed and so on. It's really embarrassing. You know, if they do come up with their own policy, if their own ideas, when they express themselves as to what we should be doing, it's an idea. It's sort of the idea that we're so good as Canada, with our NGOs and our charity and our aid, that if anything, we need to be out there doing more. We need more Canada. And sometimes they might oppose a military action without really getting into the reasons why and how it all works. But they'll say, why don't we have more aid? Why don't we have more NGOs over there? Why don't we do this for refugees? Why don't we do that? And it ties into this concept of liberal nationalism. It's sort of this positive conception of what Canada is or what it should be. So we see this throughout the institutional left, whether it be the NDP or the labor unions or the think tanks or the public intellectuals. So what's this liberal nationalism, this Pearsonian Stephen Lewis vision of Canada that informs the NDP and all these other bodies?
Well, you see it even with, like, Afghanistan, even on an issue where finally, after lots of grassroots pressure, after lots of opinion polls showing Canadians weren't supportive of the war in Afghanistan, if you look at the criticism that Jack Layton, the former head of the party, made, and the other defense critic and others at different points, we have our soldiers are tied up in Afghanistan, and that's making it so that we can't send more troops to a UN mission in Sudan, or we can't send more troops to a UN mission in Haiti. We can't be doing what's supposed to be our traditional benevolent UN peacekeeping role. So basically, they're saying we have to lessen our military involvement here, so we can bully someone else there. They can't just say, okay, let's just withdraw the troops because either this is not working or this is immoral. The criticism is couched in, it's implicit that Canada is just a force for good, and so we just have to be doing good somewhere else. And then that, as you pointed out, is really this liberal nationalist ideology. Obviously, just to back up a second, the military likes that type of criticism, because it's saying that it's not challenging the military budget, it's not challenging the industries that make money off of the military. So if you're saying just move from one military endeavor to another, you're not going at the actual institution. So that there's one reason why that criticism is appealing to power. But the other reason for why that type of criticism fits into power is it fits into this ideology that Canada is a benevolent force in the world, that it's tied to peacekeeping, it's tied to responsibility to protect, and it's tied to this whole conception of benevolent Canadian foreign policy. And polls show that Canadians are among the strongest believers in their country's role around the world, and it's upheld very aggressively by left wing institutions, be it the Rideau Institute, left wing thinkers and politicians, someone like Stephen Lewis. And it's just, it takes someone like Stephen Lewis, and he doesn't. His only criticism of Canada's role in Africa that I came across, and I researched this very in depth, the only criticism I came across that he made of Canada's role in Africa, he's obviously very well known as the biggest proponent of Africa in Canada. The criticism is that Canada's not doing enough. They haven't given enough aid. And he sometimes can make that criticism in really over-the-top, aggressive terms, like, Africa's going to fail if there's not more aid put in. Funnily enough, he never really investigates what Canadian aid has been used for in Africa. So, for instance, Canadian aid was used to support militaries in the post-colonial period, to maintain those militaries of former British colonies, to maintain them as close to the British military, close to Western military. And in the case of Ghana in 1966, Canadian aid actually went to into Canadian-trained military, ousted Kwame Nkrumah, well-known Pan-Africanist. Also, if you look more recently, Canadian aid has gone to structural adjustment programs, which have been incredibly devastating across the continent. Canadian aid has gone to supporting Canadian mining companies. So the criticism doesn't look at how are our policies undermining African liberation, African sovereignty, and how are our corporations extracting the wealth of Africa, I mean, because Canadian mining companies being the preeminent force on the continent, $30 billion or so of Canadian mining investment in Africa, that they're taking out billions of dollars every year in profit. So the criticism doesn't look into those policies, and that's really the, when you get into the thrust of Canadian policy in Africa, that is what the thrust of Canadian policy is. It's about supporting mining companies. It's about Canada being tied in with U.S., British, and to some extent French influence on the continent. Those types of criticisms are just basically pushed aside, and it's, the presumption is that Canadian policy is inherently benevolent, and that Canadian policy is being driven by corporations and by imperial thinking, but rather by benevolence.
Yes, and you're listening to Unusual Sources here on 93.3 CFMU, broadcasting live out of McMaster Radio, and you're available online at cfmu.ca. We are, of course, speaking about Eve Engler's brand new book, Left Right, Marching to the Beat of Imperial Canada's Foreign Policy, which is launching in Hamilton on the 24th of September. You can find information at hcsw.ca. Now, this book, again, it's why and how the institutional left fails to oppose this imperialism, these activities by development agencies, by Canadian corporations, mining companies, and so on that you're referring to there, Eve. And I recall when my undergraduate class was invited to go to a lecture with Stephen Lewis here at McMaster, and he talked about, you know, look at these people, they're suffering, and here's a child who's sick, and there's AIDS, and it's so bad, but we can help, and we have our Canadian involvement, and so on and so on. And everyone was just tearing up, and it was just, oh, so heartwarming, and we can do something. And it appeals to youth, also to baby boomers. I think Brendan Campisi or someone on Twitter was talking about baby boomers, they have this vision of a Canada, this liberal Canada that's so kind and generous and helping, and all we want to do is go to Africa, give them a hand up, you know, help them up, and they think that, for example, the Harper government was this giant move away from that nice Canada. So there's this vision of a nice Canada, and we have some of these left-wing think tanks that are reproducing the ideology of Canada as peacemaker, Canada as aid distributor, and only as that. So you could mention briefly the Rideau Institute here. I think they're promoting this ideology of peacekeeping. You know, how does that translate to their approaches on things like Haiti or Palestine?
Yeah, well, the Rideau Institute is maybe Canada's only sort of foreign policy think tank. It sort of skews towards the military sphere, so it tends to less be involved in more sort of diplomatic area of discussion. First of all, the head of the Rideau Institute, Peggy Mason, as somebody who's three decades of background in Canadian foreign policy, she was worked for the right-hand person for Joe Clark, who was Brian Mulroney's foreign policy foreign minister. And so she's got this whole background. She, you know, in 2012, she talks about how she has been working for NATO for the past 10 years. So she does trainings for NATO soldiers in UN peacekeeping missions. So she's somebody, and she continues to do that until at least as of a few months ago. So she's somebody she's from the sort of peacekeeping end of the establishment discussion, and that's who heads up the leading critical foreign policy institute in the country. So, in other words, not somebody who's really going to rock the boat on Canadian foreign policy. Now, if you take a look at one of the people they've collaborated with the most, Walter Dorn. Walter Dorn is the leading advocate of peacekeeping in this country. He's a professor at the Royal Military College in Kingston, which is a military-run university run by the Department of Defense. And
And Walter Dorn is just basically a blanket proponent of peacekeeping. So if it's a UN mission, it's ipso facto good. He actually was part of, had actually an administrative role with the UN mission in Haiti. That was the outgrowth of the 2004 coup against the elected president and thousands of other elected officials who were overthrown in 2004. And then there were thousands of people killed in the aftermath with UN troops providing decisive military support for that that policy. Walter Dorn was you know, actually had an administrative role within that mission, and he lauds that the UN, the MINUSTAH, as it's known, the French acronym, repeatedly in his writing. He even gets into lauding operations in Cité Soleil, and anyone who's paid attention to the Cité Soleil being the main slum area of Port-au-Prince, when he was paid attention to the Haitian aftermath of the coup, knows there was these terrible massacres in Cité Soleil. In one instance, on July 6th of 2005, there was 23 people, at least 23 people killed.
That was the UN doing that?
This was a UN mission, yes. It was UN forces that killed 23 people. It is nighttime operation, ostensibly to get a gang leader. And gang leader, it was the line between sort of politics and criminality, very unclear line within Cité Soleil. This was the community very much saw the individual Dread Wilmé as a resistance to the foreign military occupation, and so this is Walter Dorn, the main collaborator with the Rideau Institute, and you know he's justified other UN missions, like the UN mission in the early 1960s in the Congo that Canada was part of, where Canadian troops played a role in the assassination of Patrice Lumumba, the independence leader in the Congo. Even in Korea, you can provide some degree of justification for the UN Korea mission in the early war in the early 1950s. So this is somebody who aligns with, you know, supported the war in Libya in 2011. His criticism, he states openly that he, you know, believes, and this is a couple of years ago, that the Canadian military budget should be the way it is. This is somebody whose books have been blurbed by Bob Ray, who is a former foreign critic for the Liberal Party, who's been blurbed by Lloyd Axworthy, who was obviously the foreign minister during the Croatian government. And so this is the sort of like dissenting voice that we're hearing coming out of the Rideau Institute, which is, it very much aligns with, you know, it's not the hard right militarist, you know, Jack Granatstein, but it's still very much the sort of liberal end of the establishment.
Eve, thanks so much for being on the program with us.
Thanks a lot for having me.
We'll catch you later.
See you.
Bye.